Support for Boston Public Radio comes from Mass General Cancer Center, dedicated to providing the latest therapies and cancer specialists who are experienced in your cancer. When you hear the word cancer, their team is ready. Learn more at massgeneral.org/cancer.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, we'll start with your calls on summer jobs from both sides of the equation. Employers who are having trouble hiring and young people who simply aren't taking those jobs. Then when Barack Obama passed the Affordable Care Act, he did not include much by way of controlling prescription drug costs. Now, as prices have skyrocketed over the past few years, progressives are pushing Biden to pick up where his former boss left off. MIT economist John Gruber will join us to discuss the best way to reduce costs without sacrificing industry innovation.
In the wake of the January 6th attack on the Capitol, officials said intelligence failure caused the breach, but a new report released 4 months after the event finds federal agencies had plenty of info about plans to storm the Capitol building. They just failed to analyze it. National security analyst Juliet Kine will join us to discuss that and more ahead. Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Good morning, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. How are you?
Excellent. Thank you.
So could President Biden's ambitious economic recovery agenda be upended by a workforce shortage? According to a U.S. Census survey, millions of people avoided looking for work in April because they feared becoming infected by the coronavirus. About 2 million women have stopped looking for work since the pandemic, likely because of disruptions in schooling and childcare. People who are laid off from high-risk jobs in the retail or food service industry have the cushion of federal unemployment benefits, which could give them the advantage to look for work that pays better or puts them at less risk. In Massachusetts, businesses are feeling these labor pains now that the state is rolling back restrictions 2 months ahead of schedule. They're in a scramble to hire, while would-be workers, a lot of them, are in no hurry to come back. So we're taking your calls asking you, are you someone who's not eager to return to your restaurant or catering or hotel job? What's keeping you from returning? You business owners out there, are you having a hard time hiring? And people who are neither, just real people, customers, etc., are you seeing evidence of this hiring shortage and fewer hours that are open, restaurants closed on particular days? And most importantly, if any of you have solutions to the problem, give us a buzz, 877-301-8970.
You know, there's a couple of great stories about this in the Globe, and one of them was talking about how the average pay for people that are workers or servers is $25,000 a year.
Yeah.
They get bad hours. They're not sure how much they're going to make. I mean, I think part of this may be the problem. And they have interviewed this woman from Chelsea, who said she had been a bartender for 19 years, decided she'd rather get a stable job with a salary, normal hours, and more affordable health care benefits. So that may be part of this too.
Well, there are a ton of. I mean, let me tell you what. Rather, not just the Globe. Yesterday or the day before, we spoke to Rob Anderson, who owns the co-owner of the canteen in Provincetown. His problem is not just, I don't think he even identified a wage issue. He said housing, lack of affordable housing.
That's
so what did
deal.
He and his partner do? They bought two
right.
houses. They're becoming landlords to their employees. Will Gilson, who owns a bunch of restaurants, including the Puritan and the Lexington, was on TV with me last week. He said it's all about lifestyle thing. People realize that the balance that they have achieved during the pandemic is much more desirable to working 24 hours a day. There's the unemployment supplement, even though a bunch of states, I think New Hampshire is actually getting rid of it, not accepting. If someone can check that to be sure,
yeah,
I'm right.
Next month, I believe.
They
got a Republican governor up there. I think that there's talk that there's a theory among a lot of business groups that the generous unemployment benefits are what keeping people.
Right.
From
and by the way, I think,
but a lot of studies say that's not true.
Well, a lot of studies say it's true on the margins, too. And if someone can confirm that Governor Sununu is doing that, there's safety concerns. There are a whole bunch of different reasons. But the bottom line is you read these stories. I'm sure you read them, too. Some restaurants are closed 2 days a week where they ordinarily wouldn't be closed at all. Retail businesses have fewer hours, all that sort of thing. So I'd be interested to hear what problems you're confronting. Or, again, if you're one of those workers not dying to go back to work, we'd like to hear from you as to why. And what is the what's the fix for the, you know, sadly, one of the fixes, did you read the story on automation? that robots are going to fill. That's a little scary, by the way.
You know what? One of these Globe stories, I think it was a Katie Johnson story, points out that a lot of places, like these water parks and ball pits that we talked about last week, although I don't know, I mean, do we really want to go back to ball pits? But in any case, in nightclubs, they thought they weren't going to be open until August 1st, and now they got to scramble to get people in there on time. They talked about this Great Wolf Lodge. Do you know about them?
Who?
Some kind of indoor park chain, water park chain.
Yeah.
I spent a lot of time with water parks when my kids were young, but I don't know about that one. But in any case, as you say, they're going to be open, just they're going to be shut down earlier in the day and at some of their places and open 5 days a week instead of 7 days a week.
You know, a lot of these also, these employers are urging people to take at least a part-time job with them as a second job. I actually will, Thursday and Friday nights, I will be working at a ball pit just to pick up a few extra dollars. 877-301-8970. And, you know, it's a real, I'm glad I don't own a business. I mean, not only because the pandemic was a nightmare, obviously, on that front, but can you imagine that you live through a year of virtual starvation, having to be incredibly creative just to stay afloat? Like in the restaurant business in Massachusetts, a quarter of the restaurants apparently closed for good, according to the Massachusetts Restaurant Association. You come out of it, you're finally smiling, and you can't stay open because you don't have enough workers who you can afford. I mean, it's they get you coming and
going. And the margins are really small in the restaurant business, aren't they?
Restaurant. But it's not just, let's be clear, it's not just restaurants.
No,
it's other
just
restaurants. Retail businesses. It's manufacturing facilities. It's virtually everything.
Well, part of this, again, you know, is I know small businesses are always say they have small margins too. They can't afford to raise wages. But let's face it, the wages in retail are pretty damn low, right?
Yeah.
I mean, how do you possibly survive?
They were pretty damn low before the pandemic, though, too, Mark.
Yeah, but I think if you take a year off and you realize there might be other avenues, and like this woman that talked about in Chelsea, been doing the same thing for 20 years, and then thought, what am I doing? Why am I doing this?
True.
And you have time to reevaluate. Maybe you have time to do some online coursework. Maybe you have time to get other skills. Maybe you have time to just take a look at your life and think, I'm going to be in a dead end forever if this is where I stay. 877-301-8970, bprwgph.org is the email. You can tweet us at Boss Public Radio. Let's start with Mike in Jamaica Plain. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Mike.
Hey, how's it going?
We're good.
Great.
So I'm calling in because I actually just hired someone for the summer yesterday. I run a small dog walking company in Boston.
Oh, great.
Uh-huh. And it really wasn't that hard. It took me about a week and a half of posting online to get a quality candidate, interviewed yesterday, and starting training on Friday.
So why are you the exception to what appears to be the rule? And by the way, if you want to say the name of your company, we're happy to have you do
it.
Sure. It's up to you.
Oh, yeah, that'd be great. It's the Fetching Hound.
Fetching Hound, good.
Yeah, and I don't know, maybe I'm tooting my own horn here, but I pay very well for the industry standard. After doing some research, you know, before putting my ad together, seems like you could expect to start somewhere between $20 and $25 an hour. I pay $50 after a month.
Wow.
I think that, I don't know, I think that was a pretty good enticement.
I think that is a very good enticement. You pay, how much?
$50, you said. So, Mike, were you paying $50 before the pandemic or during the pandemic, or is that just a post-pandemic thing so you can get a worker?
Oh, actually, it's a little bit lower. Like, just because of the nature of the pandemic, everything's a little more spread out for us now. An experienced worker going at full speed before the pandemic would make about $60 to $65 an hour.
Oh. Mike, thank you. Good luck with your Fetching Hound or business. We appreciate your call. By the way, I was right about New Hampshire. On June 19th, New Hampshire Governor Sununu will stop accepting the federal supplemental $300 a week. I assume, I haven't read the stories, I just heard that and I just checked it out. That is because he thinks it's a disincentive, as a number of people do, even though I have to agree with you, most of the studies I've seen have said that other than on the margins, it is not proven to be.
Well, you know, we talked about this yesterday. There's kind of this assumption that people who are not making much money are always scamming. I mean, that was the theory about if you give people extra pay, as they've done in Chelsea and some of these other towns, just that's minimum pay, whatever it is, an extra $400 a month, whatever it is, that they're going to go out and spend it at casinos and buying lobsters and spending it on all these irresponsible ways. And in fact, the studies have proved otherwise. Maybe this is another one of those longtime legends, you know, that people can't wait to stay home and scam the system.
But, I mean, they're clearly, it's not scamming the system. They're entitled. If they're entitled, they can't turn down a job, which is offered, and still get unemployment insurance, as Joe Biden said.
Well, I mean that in the sense of they're being lazy. I mean, this kind of notion that people are being lazy. And I don't know that that's necessarily true at all.
Why do you have to be lazy if you're making more money?
Because it's a nasty theory that you have about women that are on welfare or people that are poor. It's one of those urban myths, I think. In some cases, maybe true, but it rarely is true.
I don't put this one in that category. I think people are entitled to this after suffering like they did this year. And I hope they want to go back to work. And I think the vast majority do. But if others want to stay and collect what they're entitled to collect, so
be it. Let me just explain myself. I mean, there is a common theory that if you give people money, they don't want to work. And I don't think that's true. But I think this has been one of these common notions that we've had. And I said in terms of the basic pay, it's been true to be untrue. Anyway, Mike in the car. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Mike.
Hi. Is this me?
Yes.
If you're Mike in the car, it's you. Yeah, hi.
Sorry. No, it's Kevin in the car.
Oh, Kevin, it's our fault. Our apologies. I was making fun of you, and now I apologize. Hi, Kevin. How are you?
I'm good. No worries. So I run a summer camp, and summer camps all around are having trouble finding staff, especially lifeguards. No one seems to want to be a lifeguard. It used to be the sort of like, you know, job to have at camps, but for some reason, nobody's coming back, or very few people are coming back.
So what's the consequence, Mike? How's that impact what you can offer campers?
Well, it depends. I mean, it's limited time in the pool. It's limited, capacities. It kind of puts us really in a tough position.
Oops, Kevin.
Through the Department of Health. Yeah, through the Department of Health, and we've got to uphold them, and we're planning for the worst case, but hoping for the best case.
Kevin, what's the name of your, if you want to tell us, what's the name of the camp? We're losing you.
It's part of the Metro West.
Say it one more time. We lost you.
Yep, Hopkinton Family Outdoor Center, and it's part of the Metro West YMCA. And,
great.
You know, there's plenty of positions available.
We look forward to talking to you again and hopefully giving us better news on the employment front. Kevin, thank you very much for the call. How depressing would that be? Again, if you live through this, you didn't even know if you're going to be open this summer. If you were going to be open, you didn't know what the rules were going to be until the governor in Massachusetts made it as an announcement on Friday. By the way, the governor's with us tomorrow, and then all of a sudden you're open and you can't hire enough people to provide the services that you like a lifeguards to staff the pool.
Well, part of the problem here it is, midway through May, I think if you're a high school kid or a college kid, you may have already gotten some other option someplace else. I mean, because a lot of these places weren't expecting to be opening full time.
That's true.
I mean, as we said, these nightclubs, indoor water parks, et cetera, weren't expected to be open until August 1st. Now they're going to be open much earlier than that, and they're having to scramble, and maybe the people that they might have hired got another gig.
By the way, if anybody, speaking of what places that weren't sure they're going to be open, if anybody listening either runs or works in a ball pit, and you can get, no, I'm serious. We want to learn more about it. One of our coworkers actually has a brother who owns one of the prominent ball pits in Massachusetts. She shall remain unnamed for the time being. Luke, you're in Phoenix. Welcome to the show. Hey, Luke.
Good morning, Jim and Marjorie.
And to you.
Put me down on being incredibly grateful for the two of you for the last 4 years.
Thank you.
You guys have been wonderful in keeping us all sane.
Thank you.
I'd just like to mention, how much do you trust your citizens after the last 4 years? I mean, really, everybody, like not everybody, but 30% of our citizens are absolutely crazy. I don't want to go out there. I don't want to be in their face. They're nuts.
Well, you're out there in Arizona, Luke, right? So you got a heavy quotient out there, right?
Oh, my goodness gracious. Don't even get me started. I mean, you really want to work for $12-15 an hour with a bunch of nuts who come out and scream in your face wearing a mask or not? I mean, that's just No, thank you.
So, Luke, is part of the shortage issue in Arizona because so many people are counting ballots at the fake audit in Maricopa County? Is that part of the problem?
We're all going down there in a few minutes and just count them and look for those nice little,
hemp, not hemp.
Hanging chads?
No, the fibers from
the... the bamboo fibers.
Bamboo fibers.
That's
that
right.
That is the most gracious thing I've ever heard.
Yeah. You know, Luke, you raise a really wonderful point, by the way. It is true, a significant percentage of the population have proven themselves to be rather, to use Luke's word, not mine, nuts. And that does, that is an inhibitor about returning to work, since you don't know what the nut quotient is going to be. Luke, thank you for an excellent call from Phoenix. Stay in touch.
Well, once again, we talked about how we have this option now to go without masks. And would you want to be a worker who's in contact every day with people without masks?
No.
Even if you are vaccinated,
no.
Having to worry about that. And that's unless restaurants or other places like outdoor and indoor venues are going to require vaccinations, then you're always going to be at least a little bit vulnerable, even if you are vaccinated.
We're going to talk a little bit later in the day to Art Kaplan, our medical ethicist, and one of the stories we're going to talk about, which is good news, is some of these huge health conferences, including one that's going to be in Boston in the fall, are mandating that if you want to come, and they're talking thousands of people.
Let's hope the health conferences, Jim, the health conferences would lead the charge on that.
Let it trickle down from them. I mean, I think it's a great start. I mean, it sends, a wonderful message. I hope other people take it to heart.
Let's go to Troy from Peabody. Thanks, Troy, for calling.
Hello, Troy.
Hi. Thanks for having me on, guys.
Pleasure.
First time, long time. Absolutely love the show.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
I just want to talk about how awful the world of retail is. Before the pandemic, I was working for an audio company that worked in hotels around Boston, so I got furloughed right away. And I had to go work at I won't say the name of the company, but I worked for a giant alcohol retail store.
Uh-huh.
And it's been awful working till 10 p.m. and then working at 5 a.m. the next day. Wages are terrible. And in our specific store, we have 8 people leaving at the same time.
Wow.
So all the managers are running around, scrambling, trying to figure out what to do. It's it kind of shows that these retail stores are kind of like too big to are so big that they're failing.
Well, you know, Troy, one solution is maybe they should pay you better. I mean, you said their wages are terrible and there's a mass exodus. Maybe if wages were a little bit better,
and
there wouldn't be a mass exodus.
And
pretty obvious to me.
Yeah, you mentioned something else, Troy, working until 10 o'clock at night and then having to be in there at 5 o'clock in the morning. That's one of the things we've talked about. We talked about this in the context of the hotel workers that went on strike a while back because they couldn't get any regular schedule, so they couldn't plan their life or their child care or who's going to pick up the kids at school. So were you in that situation, it sounds like, at a liquor store?
Absolutely, yes. Every day I'm absolutely exhausted and I'm spending all my money on rent and food. I have like no money to do anything else. It's definitely a part of this country we need to take a hard look at and really figure something out.
That's one of the reasons why there are a lot of people in Congress, not enough yet, that argue for a living wage. And even the living wage that they're suggesting is not, in my opinion, much of a living wage, but it's better than what we have. Troy, we wish you a lot of luck. We really do, and we'd love to hear from you again. We hope things take a turn for the better. You know, every single time we talk about wages, and we happen to mention one of us living wage, the $15 thing that they're aiming for, that Biden wants to, I want to repeat the federal minimum wage. And again, if it's higher in your state, then that's what controls. The federal minimum wage is $7.25. I believe New Hampshire is the same. Isn't it tied to the federal minimum wage?
I don't know.
I mean, it is unimaginable to me that the most pro-business legislator believes it when he or she says, well, that's all they can afford to pay, so we shouldn't force them to pay more. Should any employer be allowed to be in business if they think $7.25 is enough to pay a worker an hour? And if they can't survive by paying them more, then they shouldn't survive, period.
Well, you have all these stories like Troy's in retail, in a liquor store, and we had it in the hotel business in Boston when the workers were striking because they couldn't get the decent hours. I mean, you hear a lot about this anecdotally. People don't have a schedule.
Yeah. I don't know how you can work without a schedule. And what is the excuse from the employers?
We can. That's what their excuse is. Yeah. We do it because we can.
And don't forget,
do it.
You know, we talked a while ago when early on in the Trump administration, I think it was like 2017 when the government shut down.
Yeah.
Remember how shocked, at least I was, to learn that federal employees, full-time, 40-hour-a-week with benefit federal employees, were making so little money that most of them couldn't go 2 weeks without having without having everything being broke. So obviously there's a wage problem. I mean, we have an income inequality
there
problem.
Is.
Scott in New Hampshire, thank you for calling.
We've got to take a break, Scott. Can you hold a second?
We have to take a break, Scott. My apologies. We'll be right back. We're talking about the state lifting restrictions ahead of schedule for opening up post-pandemic and what it means for local businesses who are scrambling and in some cases in desperate straits trying to hire people. The conversation continues on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. If you're just tuning in, we're talking about a labor shortage, both here and across the country, what it means for local businesses here. Now that Governor Baker has lifted restrictions ahead of schedule, again, he'll be with us tomorrow. We're taking calls from business owners asking how you're managing workers. Are you amongst those who've decided you don't want to go back yet? And if that's the case, tell us why. And if you're just a customer of one of these businesses, what are you seeing that's different because of the inability of the people who own a store or a restaurant that you've patronized just can't hire enough staff?
You know, I was bumbling when I was trying to explain my argument about how I don't buy the idea that people are staying home because they don't want to work. Mm-hmm. Patty put it much better. She just emailed. She said, if someone doesn't want to go back to work because they're getting a couple hundred dollars extra from unemployment now, perhaps it's not because the government is giving too many handouts. Perhaps it's because those companies are not paying high enough wages to live on or to compete with a government subsidy. I think she's got it. That's the issue. I mean, you have these stories about people that are working in the restaurant business, particularly not knowing how much they're going to get in tips or if they're in the front of the house, in the back of the house. This Globe story talks about an average salary of $15 to $30, but even that is not really enough for most people to live in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts.
You know, but what's her name again?
Patty.
Can she come in and co-host the show? I mean, she obviously was able to articulate the point beautifully. So if you're
That's
available,
right.
Patty, send me a note.
Patty did a better job than I did.
877-301-8970. Scott, my apologies. I slowed you down. Welcome to the show from New Hampshire. Hi.
Well, this is my third time calling. I love you guys. You guys got me through this pandemic. And the last 6 months of homelessness, by the way.
I'm sorry.
Living in I got evicted because I wasn't aware that you have to file paperwork in order to take advantage of the CDC's moratorium. So they kicked me out of my place, and I've been kind of roaming around ever since, trying not to run out of money because I'm on disability. But anyway, in New Hampshire, it's $7.25. You're right about
I know.
That. And that's ridiculous. And you guys finally got to the right point, which is that it is the fact that we don't pay people enough money. And it seems to me that this is going to go the same way as everything else does in this country. This pandemic brought out so many discrepancies and problems that need to be dealt with. But once it's over, they'll all be forgotten. Because right now, this whole idea of all these Republican governors and state people, politicians saying that the money is what's causing people not to go to work and not addressing the actual problem that people aren't paid enough to live on, and that's simply the answer. And nobody's saying that. None of the politicians are saying that. They're all saying, oh, it's the money. It's the lack of the money.
Yeah.
You know, Scott, Marjorie was just complimenting Patty for saying it perfectly. You were
you
in that
too.
Group, too. You did, too. And we wish you a lot of luck. And please let us know about your progress, Scott, from New Hampshire. By the way, Callie has a commentary, Callie Crossley, our colleague, on GBHnews.org. It's called It's Time to Stop Bashing Workers. And it's on this very topic,
great.
Making the point that there are a lot of Republicans who are skewing the facts about these unemployment benefits, as Marjorie and Patty and Scott were just saying a minute ago. So please check it out.
Is right. I mean, we are so screwed up in so many ways. We talk endlessly about the fact that during this pandemic, when tens of thousands of people, more than that, obviously across the country, millions of people lost their jobs. Some of the people that ran those companies that laid off those tens of thousands of people, you know, got massive raises, mm-hmm. 23 million, 50 million, 75 million. I mean, we're...
Why is that, Marjorie? Because they're doing exactly what they were hired to do. Screw workers. I mean,
well,
it is.
Yeah, and I think that's, I mean, we seem to just roll over and take it. Anyway, where are we going?
We'll go in a second. 877-301-8970.
Oh, Patrick, somebody else from New Hampshire. Hi, Patrick.
Hey, Patrick.
Hey, Jim, hey. Marjorie, how are you guys doing?
We're good. Thanks for calling.
All right. Long-time listener, huge fan. Thank you guys so much
for
what you do.
Thank you.
Also from New Hampshire, I concur the 725 is a little ridiculous. I started working when I was 14 years old, and it was fine then. But now that I'm almost 30,
yeah.
It's not enough.
Exactly.
But no, I mean, you know, I was a bartender for 6 years at a brewery, and during COVID, they one day just announced that the whole operation was shutting completely down. And I was fortunate enough, I got picked up by a financial institution that sent me a laptop and allows me to work completely remote, which is awesome. You know, in terms of my comfort level with returning to work, my father had COPD. He's fully vaccinated, but I still worry, you know, if I were to go back into an office setting, that I could expose him to something that might hurt him. And I guess the last thing I'll say is, as much as I disagree with some of the policies, I do generally like Sununu as a governor. I voted for him every time.
One of the many Sununus, I should say, a former senator, another former governor. Patrick, you know why I'm really glad you called? Because we mentioned it at the top of the hour, but we left it out of the mix. A lot of people have legitimate health concerns, too, in your case about a family member. But it's totally understandable after coming out of the trauma or through the trauma of this past 14 months. That's a really important factor we have to consider, too. So good luck with your dad and good luck with your work stuff. Patrick, thanks for calling. 877-301-8970. You know, it's really, he said that he's voted for Governor Sununu and he likes him, et cetera, which obviously is great. It's pretty tough, it seems to me, unless the case is conclusive, which, as you have made clear, it is far from, that you say, I'm not going to take federal dollars for supplemental benefits for people who are unemployed because I buy into a theory that that is what is causing the shortage. If it was 100% clear, I think it's a fair debate to have. Considering it's nowhere near clear at all, as you've articulated a bunch of times, that's a hell of a move by a leader of a state. And by the way, with all due respect to Governor Sununu, he's not alone. There are a ton of other governors, I think all Republican, I'm not sure, who are making similar moves, which is troubling, I think.
Well, you have it's like a Ronald Reagan with the welfare queen. Remember, you used to talk about that?
Oh, I do indeed.
And you have these anecdotes. Oh, my goodness, there's somebody on food stamps in front of me that was buying a lobster at the supermarket. And, wow, I guess that means everybody's buying lobster at the supermarket.
And also it means that a poor person shouldn't be allowed to spend a piece of their income,
well,
even if it's from the government, on joy,
remember,
you know?
The great whoopie pie story from a few years ago? It had to be 10 or 15 years ago now. But there was some woman who was on food stamps who has her kid with her at one of these farmers markets.
In Massachusetts.
Yeah. Massachusetts, that's right. And she tried to buy a whoopie pie, you know, one of those chocolate things. And for her kid. And the vendor wouldn't sell it to her because she said she wasn't going to accept food stamps for a whoopie pie. She became like this heroine across the state, at least for a while.
Remember who became one of her champions, by the way, our colleague? Michael Graham.
Okay.
Michael Graham was
I think I interviewed her, too, when I was at the Herald. I'm pretty
column.
Sure I did. Yeah, because it was a big issue. The whoopie pie thing went on for weeks. Anyway, Andrew.
Sort of like Mr. Potato. We only have a minute, so let's squeeze one more.
Oh, sorry. Real quick, Andrew. I'm sorry. Andrew from Somerville.
Hi, Andrew.
Hi. Thank you. Long-time listener. I just wanted to mention I've been a lifetime restaurant employee. mm-hmm. and I've been only offered underemployment, like a single shift.
Wow.
So I'm getting called in. They say, hey, can you come in, you know, in 2 days for one day, and we'll see what happens.
Huh. And why is that, Andrew?
Restaurants are in a pinch, so I think they're just looking to take what they can get. But they can't offer full employment because they don't know where they're going.
So what do you do? And in response?
I'd say, I'm sorry. Like, I can't take a promise for a job without a promise for full-time employment.
Yeah.
Well, that's another, obviously, excellent reason, and we're glad you added that to the mix. Andrew, good luck to you, too, and thank you for the call. You know, there's a lot of desperation out there, continued. The feeling is, you know, the pandemic is winding down. 16 states yesterday had zero deaths. But listen to the people who called the show today.
Yeah.
The underemployed, the unemployed, the underpaid. I mean, it's
well,
tough.
As he points out, are you going to give up whatever unemployment you're getting that you know you're going to get at least for a while longer to get the uncertainty of taking a shift or two shifts? It's not going to get you anywhere
not.
Near. You just can't do it. Anyway, up next, now that we're used to getting life-saving drugs for free, as in the COVID vaccines, Americans want government to focus on lowering the cost of drugs. We're going to talk to our MIT economist, John Gruber, on that conversation. That's next on 89.7 GBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. From the exorbitant cost of the EpiPen, courtesy of Joe Manchin's daughter, by the way, to the diabetics who died because they could not afford insulin, Big Pharma has long had a PR problem as a ruthless industry that prioritizes profit over people. Then came the COVID extreme makeover. Who would have thought the American public would feel such gratitude toward places like Pfizer, Johnson & Johnson, Moderna? Does that have anything to do with the fact that the COVID vaccines not only came out at warp speed, but that they are free? According to a new poll, 85% of Americans, not surprisingly, said that Congress should prioritize passing a bill to bring down prescription drug costs, 50% saying it should be a top priority. Democrats are split on the best way to do it. Congressional Republicans have their reservations, not surprisingly. At the crux of the debate appears to be as if lowering the cost of drugs will also inhibit innovation because it will keep, goes the argument, pharmaceutical companies from developing new drugs. Joining us online for his take on this and a survey of the current debate is Jonathan Gruber. John is the Ford Professor of Economics at MIT, instrumental in creating both the Massachusetts healthcare reform and the Affordable Care Act. His latest book is Jumpstarting America, How Breakthrough Science Can Revive Economic Growth and the American Dream. John Gruber, welcome back.
Thanks.
Hey, John Gruber, great to talk to you. So listen, before we get to Democrats' plans, Republican plans, your ideas about prices and big pharma, how do we get to the crazy place, before the pandemic, when we were talking about these $600 EpiPens and diabetics who couldn't afford their insulin? How do we get there?
Well, the answer is really quite simple, Jim and Marjorie, which is that we don't regulate prices. And as we've discussed repeatedly on this show, economics works well to get us to the right outcome when markets work well, when there's complete information for consumers, when there's vigorous competition among producers. That is not the case in drug markets. Drug markets have very incomplete information for consumers and very incomplete competition among producers. As a result, our drug prices are really high and much higher than the rest of the world, which regulates their prices. So, for example, let's take Humira, which is a great drug for rheumatoid arthritis. Mm-hmm. The international average cost of Humira is $1,500 a dose. The lowest developed country pays $900. We pay $2,300. Gleevec for cancer. The lowest country pays $1,000. We pay $6,200.
Wow.
And overall, as a result, we spend 14% of our healthcare dollars, or about $575 billion a year, on drugs. More importantly, one in five cancer patients report financial difficulties associated with their care. And so we are based on a situation where, once again, we're falling behind the rest of the world. The rest of the world has recognized this is a broken market, and they need to have government regulations to fix it. We don't, and we pay the price.
You know, before we get to current events and what proposals are on the table, I have two questions based on what you just said there, John Gruber. One, You were pretty intimately involved in the architecture of the Affordable Care Act. Why didn't Obamacare fix the problem?
Basically, regulating drug prices is really hard because, there was a famous healthcare economist named Uwe Reinhardt, and Uwe Reinhardt's first law was healthcare costs equals healthcare income. When you regulate healthcare costs, someone's losing. And the drug companies are a very concentrated lobby through the pharma lobby, and it's hard to make them lose. So I think that basically it's a standard difficult issue. We've talked about the show ad nauseum, Jim, which is bad politics getting in the way of good economics.
And in a second preliminary question, when you're talking about our drug prices compared to other countries, and I always find that the most interesting, particularly when people say, well, if we regulate prices or have any cost controls here, it's going to stymie innovation. Didn't Donald Trump attempt to tie our drug prices to drug prices in other countries? And if I'm right about that, which seems to me to be a wonderful idea, what happened to it?
So let's talk about the policy options here.
Okay.
But let's first talk about another problem before we get to what Trump did and what we should do.
Okay.
One problem is prices are high. The other thing is that despite high prices and great innovation in the drug industry, drug development under-responds to social needs. So there are new products developed all the time that don't offer large clinical advantages, like a new drug for skin cancer, which costs $120,000 to extend your life for 3 months, or places where the profitability is low, but the social needs are great, like vaccines. So we have these two problems. We spend too much on the drugs we make, and we make the wrong drugs. So both of those have an easy answer, right? In theory, it's an easy answer, which is value-based regulation.
What does that mean?
What that means is, quite simply, we should have a government entity, in the U.S. we have a nonprofit entity that does this called the Institute for Comparative Effectiveness Research, which basically says, look, based on the clinical trials, here is the value that a drug adds in terms of improving health. So, for example, if you take a drug like Sovaldi, which cures Hep C, essentially cures an uncurable disease, the value is in the multi-millions. If you take another drug which extends life by a month or two, the value would be a much lower number. Mm-hmm. And then the regulators would set the prices of drugs according to that value. That's what other countries try to do. So what the U.S. Congress did, and what Trump actually did as well, was actually something a little bit clever, which was say, look, quite frankly, we don't have the guts to regulate drug prices. Other countries do. Why don't we just lean on them and tie our drug prices to theirs?
What's wrong with that?
So, honestly, not a ton. Now, that's the crux of what's H.R. 3, that's the leading House Democrat proposal, is essentially to say that for a basket of our leading drugs in America, the 275 leading drugs in America, the Secretary of Health and Human Services would attempt a value-based negotiation, but if it failed, the backstop is the U.S. would not pay more than 120% of an international basket of prices.
Sounds
now, you can get into what countries should be in the basket.
Sure.
Is 120% the right number? But in general, I don't think it's a terrible idea. I mean, I prefer that we would ignore what other countries do and just do the right thing. But I kind of like it as a backstop of saying, look, the Secretary should do these negotiations, but we need some, in case negotiations fail, we need a backstop. I think it's not a bad idea at all. But as you mentioned in the introduction, the controversy it's raised is that people claim, well, if you lower drug prices, it would lead to less drug innovation. So let's talk about that for a minute, because that's very important. Okay. Indeed, the Congressional Budget Office, who I've praised before on this show, they're the last rational man standing in Washington, D.C. They are the objective truth tellers in Washington, D.C. They have been brave enough to not only say that H.R. 3, the main Democrat proposal, which, as I said, would regulate the price of the 275 most expensive drugs in America, would save almost $500 billion over a decade. They've also said that it would result in fewer drugs being developed, on the order of 30 fewer drugs over a decade. Why is that?
Well, before you go ahead, because 30 doesn't mean much in the abstract, 30 out of how many are likely to be
You know, over a decade, you know, we don't know, but it's let's call it 5%.
Okay, go ahead, continue.
To throw a number out there.
Okay.
Now, why does CBO think this? Well, they think this because there is a bunch of evidence out there that if pharma makes less money, they'll do less R&D and less drugs will result. The direction of the effect is unambiguous. It is true. They won't take all the money to do less R&D. They'll take some of the money to do less advertising and some to make less profits. But it's true. If they make less money, they'll do less R&D. And let's be clear, pharma R&D is incredibly valuable. The pharmaceutical industry does 10% of all R&D in America. They do a third of all manufacturing R&D.
Wow.
They're an important source of innovation in this country. But here's what that argument misses. They're not the only important source of innovation in this country. And now we come to my book, Jumpstarting America, with Simon Johnson.
Yes.
Which is that the government is a very important source of innovation funding in the U.S. And what I've argued in work I'm doing jointly with Rena Conti at Boston University and Richard Frank at Harvard is that, in fact, if you devote just a fraction of the savings from H.R. 3 to government-sponsored R&D, you can have a win-win. You can have more new drugs. It's a win-win-win, actually. You can have more new drugs, drugs which are more socially valuable, not just extending life by a month, and still save a ton of money to spend on other healthcare priorities.
You know, John, it seems to me there's one other slant at this, which is relevant. If the argument that has to be countered by mostly the Republicans and the pharmaceutical companies themselves is it'll stifle innovation. We just discussed a few minutes ago how prices are controlled, regulated, whatever the appropriate verb is, in a lot of European countries, other countries. Has it stifled innovation there?
Well, it's a hard question to answer, Jim. Most of the innovation happens in the U.S.
I see.
So it is absolutely true that we pay the highest prices, and those prices really do sponsor a lot of R&D. So it is true. The other way to answer that question would be, well, do they have less access to drugs than we do?
Mm.
And the answer is a little bit less. It is true that drugs get there a little bit later, and there are some drugs in the U.S. which are not approved in other countries. So there is a bit of a trade-off, and that's why I think, you know, so we could think about the drug price regulations having two potential costs. One is, would it limit which drugs are developed? And there's a potential for that. That's absolutely true. Just pure, if we full stop pass H.R. 3, I agree with CBO, we will see fewer drugs. I'm not sure there'll be drugs that actually do that much good for our health, but we'll see fewer of them.
But doesn't it mean that people in who consume, you know, if you have diseases and you have to consume a lot of drugs, you're kind of subsidizing the people that need the same drugs in European countries if you're an American?
Well, that's a great point, Marjorie. The rest of the world free rides on the U.S.
Yeah.
So the way to think about it is we pay high prices, we develop the drugs, the rest of the world, with some delay, benefits from. So the best answer would be get the rest of the world to pay higher prices. But we can't do that. So the challenge is that's why there's a trade-off, a potential trade-off. If we lower price, we get less innovation. But it's not really a trade-off if we take some of that money and recycle into public funding. Let me give you the following fact. If we took less than 10% of the savings from this bill, maybe about 5% of the savings, and gave it to the National Institutes of Health to invest in basic science that becomes basic pharmaceutical innovation, by estimates by my colleagues here at MIT, we would create 30 new drugs for 5% of the spending. 5% of the savings given to NIH, based on estimates of the effect of past NIH funding, would create 30 new drugs to offset the loss in pharma innovation. And you still have 95% of the money left over. So the point is that it's not an irreconcilable trade-off. It's a trade-off that we can have it all. We can have lower drug prices, more rationalized drug prices, and extra money for other priorities in America if we reinvest some of the savings in public R&D.
So is the answer to the stupid question, why don't they do the obvious thing in Washington, is because they don't do anything about anything, at least in a bipartisan fashion? Or is there more to it? If it's so obvious, why are they not embracing it, particularly if it doesn't cause the pharmaceutical companies great pain.
Well, you know, many of us remember West Wing as sort of a touch point for what many liberals think the way government should run. You will remember the president of West Wing had a PhD in economics. Let's not forget that. Part of the reason things aren't going the way they should is because, you know, we're not getting enough emphasis on the economics. And that's, you know, what I'm trying to do and others are trying to do. I think that it's too easy to stop at the simple talking point of, gee, it'll kill innovation. And it's more complicated to say, well, actually, it might not if you recycle them. You know, the conversation gets more complicated. And so it's very important to really explain in the simple possible terms, you know, why this kind of recycling of the money towards public R&D can actually let us get to a win-win solution. And it's very important to explain as well this other point I made. It's not just that we pay high prices. The innovation that happens in the U.S., a lot of it is kind of wasteful. Some of it's fundamental. I mean, as I said, the drugs we developed the last 50 years in America have been life-saving and life-changing. If you think about mental health, cancer, other things, the change has been tremendous. That said, a lot of the innovation hasn't been. Okay? So really, I think the other point, people just look at, oh, gee, we'll get less innovation, that's bad. Well, what about the fact that with proper price signals, you'll get better innovation? If we have a system which says, you know what, we're not going to pay you much for a drug that for a new Me Too drug, but we'll actually maybe pay you even more for a drug that does great good, well, that might shift the way we do things. Let's take one of the most significant drug developments of the last 10 years. The first truly effective genetic therapy, which is a treatment for what's called spinal muscular atrophy in babies. It's a horrible disease that destroys babies' lives, kills them by age 2, just terrible. A company has come up with a cure for spinal muscular atrophy. I mean, it gives me chills just thinking about it. Literally, this horrible disease has been cured through genetic therapy that's injected to the body. It's a genetic therapy that cures the disease. They've priced it at $2.1 million.
Wow.
That's a lot of money.
$2.1 per kid.
Per kid. The whole treatment is $2.1 million. It saves the kid's life. That's a lot of money. Quite frankly, it's worth it. Now, it could be less, but the truth is, relative to paying $100,000 to extend your life for 3 months, this is an incredible deal. Okay, $2.1 million, you can extend life by 80 years. Here's a fascinating fact. It's the first drug I know of that was priced at the same level in the UK. So the point is, value-based drug price regulation does not have to dissuade valuable innovation. Drugs which are valuable can get high prices, and they should get high prices. It's just we need to dissuade high prices for drugs that aren't valuable.
You know, may I ask a quick question here? I'm talking with Jonathan Gruber, MIT economist. Correct me if I'm wrong, I'm not sure, but didn't the government used to spend a lot more money on research and development in general? I don't know if they did it specific to the pharmaceutical industry, but I thought that that was a big thing for the United States of America historically.
Well, thank you for the softball question, Marjorie. That's sort of the fundamental point of my book, Jumpstarting America.
Yeah.
So it's a softball question, a little disappointing question there, Marjorie, because that is the fundamental point of my book, Jumpstarting America, which you plug at the start and end of every show.
That's right. Well, I should have pointed out that was the fundamental point of your book. I knew I read it somewhere. I knew I saw that brilliant insight somewhere, Jonathan.
Which is that in the mid-1960s, 2% of the entire U.S. economy, or one in every $50, was government-sponsored R&D. And everything in our modern modern technological world came out of that, from the planes we fly to the computers we use to the GPS, which helps us from getting lost, to modern pharmaceuticals, all came out of that public R&D. It's now 0.6% of GDP. We can talk about this another time. The good news is the Senate just has bring this into the floor, a new bill which would put about $50 billion a year into increased funding for our National Science Foundation. It's a very exciting development, just came out yesterday. We could talk about that another time. But still, even if we had $50 billion, that takes us from 12th in the world and half of China to 9th in the world and 55% of China. So
wow.
We still are way too low in terms of our public R&D spending.
You know, John,
so basically, we need to do more of it.
We only have a couple minutes left. Every time we talk about drugs, I ask you the same question, so I will do it again. The most incredible thing I've learned, maybe from you, is that there is statutory prohibition on the Medicare negotiating drug prices in most cases with pharmaceutical companies. My understanding
right.
is H.R. 3, the Democratic proposal in the House, addresses this. Could you explain for the ninth time how anybody could justify such a preclusion?
Well, the answer is what we've been discussing. The justification is that the government will go too far and push prices down so far that innovation doesn't happen. It's a standard argument. You know, you say the same thing about why do people think the government shouldn't regulate what doctors get paid? Because it'll drive the price down too far and doctors will leave the business. It's the same argument here over and over again. And that's why the discussion we're having today is so important. Because for twofold. First of all, that counterargument doesn't appreciate the fact that if the secretary does value-based negotiation, it could raise prices for drugs that we need, while lowering for drugs we don't. That's the first point it misses, as you know, the genetic therapy example pointed out. The second point it misses is there doesn't have to be a trade-off if you take some of the money and put it into public R&D.
So, John, maybe we can do this off the air, but if you want to do it here, in light of the fact that Congress will do absolutely nothing, you want to have the exact same discussion in a year, 2 years. You know what's amazing about...
Jim, I don't want to let your negativity take over here, man.
Well, good. I'm going to try to be positive for a second. Even if a significant number of Republicans are in the pocket of big business, in this case, big pharma, it's hard to think of an issue where there is probably as much unanimity about the need for action
in polls
as on drug prices.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, talk to
people
anybody.
People really want a change.
You know,
30 seconds.
It's for two reasons, Jim. One is it's the most salient price we pay. We see it. The second is those goddamn Viagra and Cialis ads. When I had to explain to my 9-year-old why the guy kept throwing the football through the tire, I was so upset. And I'm telling you, those ads will end up in historical records said and done. They're going to backfire in the pharma industry, and they're going to be part of the reason we eventually get drug price regulation.
Next time you're on, can you explain why the guy's able to throw the football through the tire? Can you?
Okay, last 15
Quick.
Seconds. True
Quick.
Story. I have a friend who's a pediatrician, and a 9-year-old came into his office and said he wanted to talk about Cialis. And the pediatrician said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, I saw an ad. It said, talk to your doctor about Cialis."
That's
because he wants to throw the football through the tire. Okay,
hey, John,
that's great, John.
All right, see you guys.
John
Be
Gruber
well.
Joins us regularly. The book we've been talking about that explains all this is Jumpstarting America, How Breakthrough Science Can Revive Economic Growth and the American Dream. Coming up, a new report finds the Department of Homeland Security failed to analyze intelligence ahead of the Capitol attacks. National security expert Juliette Kime is here to walk through that and more next on 89.7 GBH Boston Public Radio.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, Massachusetts residents can't buy or sell assault weapons, but the state is home to Smith & Wesson, one of the largest gun makers, including of AR-15s, in the country. So does Massachusetts bear responsibility for exporting gun violence to the rest of the country? And what can we do about it? Bina Venkatraman, Boston Globe editorial editor, will join us to discuss the newspaper's latest editorials on guns and on embattled Boston Police Commissioner Dennis White.
The Supreme Court will take up a case that may have broad implications on abortion access across the country. While states like Massachusetts have their own protections, others are poised to end abortion immediately if federal protections are taken away. Medical ethicist Art Kaplan will join us to discuss the challenge to Roe v. Wade, the latest on reopening from COVID, plus the latest news about UFOs. Then we'll open the lines and ask you, are you rooting for the UFOs to be real or not? All that ahead, Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Brady, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Hour Number 2 of Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Hello again, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. So joining us to go over the latest national security headlines, sadly not including rogue Chinese rockets, is Juliette Kayyem. Wow. Juliette's a former assistant secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, faculty chair of the Homeland Security Program at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government, and of course an analyst for CNN. Juliette Kayyem, welcome.
Hi, both of you.
Hello, Juliette. Good to talk to you.
Good to see you. I mean, video-wise, but...
So, let's start with some politics in D.C., Juliette Kayyem.
Yeah.
There's been long talk of having a real thorough investigation. A bipartisan agreement was reached. We have this commission to look at January 6th, what happened there. Kevin McCarthy, the minority leader, is opposed to it. Why?
Well, I mean, you know, the real reason is Congress is implicated and members of Congress are implicated because any thorough investigation will show, will need to determine how did a rally turn into an insurrection, right? How did that organization occur? Who was talking to whom? Who was paying whom to get there? Who was organizing whom? And then, of course, we know from real-time reporting that McCarthy and others were calling the White House. They knew exactly who this group supported and who exactly could keep them or get them out of Congress that day. Mitch McConnell said as much by later in January and February when he said that Trump was responsible. So Congress is implicated in this the GOP will just be obstructionist about this. So their first line of attack was, we don't want one. And then Pelosi goes forward. It's like, okay, we need to negotiate. So then they negotiate a bipartisan agreement, and then it's moving forward, and they say we don't support it because it's duplicative or whatever phony excuse they're coming up with. So I'm not optimistic about, even if it's formed, what this commission can do. And we know who the Republicans are going to put on it. And my worry is it turns, you know, January 6th into another sort of laughing stock, as this GOP often does. And McConnell has since said that he opposes it.
Can we stay on this just for a minute? Because, you know, you are the creator of Pace the Rage. I cannot pace my rage on this thing. You know, Jim McGovern, the chair of the House Rules Committee from Worcester, he's going to be with me tonight on TV. He's on CNN last night. He holds up a letter that was sent to the committee that was putting this bipartisan thing together from McCarthy, the would-be speaker, saying, here are the conditions without which we will not agree to this. They met every single condition. The Republican appointed by him, the ranking minority member on the Homeland Security Committee, on McCarthy's authority, agreed to a deal. So it's not only because McCarthy and other members of Congress are going to be embarrassed. It's obviously, to me, McCarthy said yes. Donald Trump calls him from Mar-a-Lago and says, don't say yes. And how high do I need to jump? And he does it. And for those who missed this.
And also, he's going to testify. He's going to testify, right?
Of course. I want to reiterate what Juliet said, or at least flesh it out a little bit. McCarthy, as Juliet said, is talking to Trump on January 6th. He's, according to a Republican congresswoman who was there, Representative Beutler, I don't know how to pronounce her name, from Washington. McCarthy is taking on Trump. Trump is repeating the falsehood that it was Antifa. McCarthy refuted it and told the president these were Trump supporters. Then they start yelling at each other. That was him on January 6th. Here's McCarthy on Fox News with Chris Wallace 3 months later describing the exact same phone call on Fox News.
I was the first person to contact him when the riots was going on. He didn't see it. What he ended the call was saying, telling me he'll put something out to make sure to stop this. And that's what he did. He put a video out later. My conversations with the president, I engaged in the idea of making sure we could stop what was going on inside the Capitol at that moment in time. The president said he would help.
How does he live with himself? How do these people live with themselves, Juliet? I know it's unanswerable.
Right. No. I mean, it's not just Trump. It's their base. I mean, this is what, you know, this is what sometimes frustrates me about coverage about a lot of this, is just its failure to acknowledge that a large proportion of the Republican base is driving this, and they don't want to go against it. And then, you know, Trump actually amplifies it. And so I think this commission probably won't amount to much. I don't know, because I don't know who the Republicans would plan on putting on it. In terms of the hearings.
Jim Jordan? Do we have to look at Jim Jordan again?
I don't think they're members of Congress, are there?
I put a new proposal out on Twitter. Here's my new proposal. So first of all, I want people to remember there's over 460 criminal cases coming out of January 6th. That is good, and those should continue. And obviously history will expose the traitors amongst us. So there is, you know, there's something there. I would, here, if I'm the Democrats, you got to start playing hardball now. So if I'm Nancy Pelosi, she can either have a Democratic commission, and I'm not sure that that impacts much, but I would fill four of the five seats. So I would say, okay, we're ready to move forward. We've got four of the five. We won't fill it. And you just keep it as a news story about who the Republicans are going to pick, because I don't think McCarthy has even committed to naming anyone. So you start to head towards this commission, and she just plays hardball, and you just keep this in the news and them on defense, but don't move forward, because everyone, if you move forward with a Democratic commission only and only five commissioners, the whole thing becomes a joke. And that's what the GOP is so good at. They are so good at making serious things into a joke, and I'm sick of it. And then the fourth piece of this, so you've got history, the prosecutions, filling four of the five seats. I don't know why we wouldn't do a presidential commission for this. I don't know what the White House has said. We don't want to touch this. But we've had them before, the Warren Commission, certainly. People forget that the BP Commission was a presidential commission. It was not a congressional commission. They can have subpoena power. They can work in tandem with criminal investigations. You have a bipartisan one, and you don't have the craziness of congressional input into a commission that should be taken, that is about a serious matter. And so that's sort of my hardball, and then try to get to the truth, new proposal, because I think this is a nightmare now.
Well, even if you have the best strategy, my understanding is what they're voting on this afternoon, despite McCarthy's behavior, is I think the House is going to vote on the bipartisan proposal.
Yeah.
Itself, and let's see if the Republicans, and there were plenty of them, who actually endorsed the idea early on, if they have the courage to stand up to McCarthy in the House, right, and to McConnell in the Senate. We're talking to Juliet Kayyem, and I'm totally aggravated.
Well,
no, I know.
This, I think, not that I've been to Dubai anytime lately, but apparently it's one of the world's, the world's busiest airport for international travel, is Dubai Airport. They've basically said no proof of vaccination, no travel.
Amen.
Yeah, so it's interesting. I mean, we've talked about this before, and I'm not a doctor, a public health official. I just, you know, help structure things around guidance that is pretty, you know, you've had plenty of doctors on about the new CDC guidance, and we're just moving forward. I think is what you're starting to see is what I've been talking about is just sort of a preference system, a burdened, unburdened system for institutions that are still concerned about the potential for either exposure or the continuing pandemic. That is showing itself in a variety of ways. I mean, you certainly saw with Cuomo and the opening up of large stadiums, including Radio City Music Hall. He said that people had to be vaccinated, and I would suspect that that is going to be some sort of form. No one should freak out about this. All it means is if you want a certain privilege, if you want to have more fun, as I said, make the world of the vaccinated more fun. So Radio City Music Hall, Madison Square Garden, traveling to the EU. The EU is going to put up vaccination protocols for travelers to the EU. They need us back. But they want us back healthy. And then as you're seeing in Dubai with global travel, Dubai is the largest, the most trafficked airport in the world. As you just think about both east and west, they're sort of converging in Dubai. It is a stunning airport. I've spent a lot of layover hours there. And that you'd have to have proof of it, because otherwise people have to understand what the alternative is that you then have to go into isolation when you arrive at that country, right?
Yeah.
Because, so think about Australia right now. Australia does not have COVID. It does not have a very aggressive vaccination yet. So if you want to go to Australia and you're vaccinated right now, I think this will change, you actually have to isolate for some period of time, which is absolutely backwards, right? In your head or in anyone's head. And so people are just going to have proof of it. It is not that big of a deal. We do it with our kids already with vaccinations to get into schools. And I think that's what you're starting to see in terms of how the world is being divided. And I want to talk about retail for a second, because I think the headlines have been a little bit misleading, like everyone's opening up, not misleading, but We're dependent on people behaving right. I think the CDC made a gamble, and they'll probably be right on it, that the vaccine hesitant or the vaccination slow people will over time get more and more comfortable or spend the time in getting vaccinated, which we're starting to see. We're moving those numbers. But Walmart, for example, did something interesting. They have 1.6 million employees. What they told their employees is, we want you to be vaccinated. This is conservative Walmart. If you're not vaccinated, you have to wear a mask. If you are vaccinated, you tell us that you're vaccinated. They're not requiring proof. But if you lie, that is grounds for dismissal. So there's a threat hanging over people who lie. And basically saying to Walmart employees, if you want to work without a mask, just get a vaccine. That's the world. I've never liked the punishment approach to any of this. I like as I had said to you earlier, you know, the TSA pre-clear analogy, which is you basically do something and life gets a little bit less burdened. And I think that's a world we're creating.
I know Marjorie's with you too. The more incentives, the better. We're talking to Juliet Kayyem. Juliet, last week we talked to you about the Colonial Pipeline thing. Yeah. And, you know, I've been thinking a lot about, you know, getting into a second business. And I told Marjorie this morning, I'm thinking of getting into the ransomware business because I didn't realize that it was beneficial. You know, most of us knew that Colonial paid, I didn't know it was $46 million, but paid, I'm sorry, paid X number of dollars, whatever it is, millions, to DarkSid. The number I got wrong is they took in $46 million in ransom over the last 3 months from a variety of places. What I didn't know is there are thousands of these things going on all the time with companies and schools and governments. And Marjorie and I read something this morning. The average payment, and I assume this was a typo, it's not, is $312,000. It sounds like in the world in which you consult, it's almost like, well, this is a cost of doing business. They're going to hack into our computers. They're going to shut down our business. They're going to say, you got to pay us $500,000 and we'll negotiate down to $312,000. Yeah. This is not an exaggeration, right?
No. And it's, look, this is a market driven pricing structure. So the hackers have to price ransomware in a way in which incentivizes the victim company to actually be willing to pay because they're offsetting it against what the consequences are. And so it's higher.
If they don't pay, consequences if they don't pay.
A school district, you know, a school district might be $40,000. And they say, look, this is the price of business. I've always been against paying it. I do think it's the equivalent of sort of material support for a criminal enterprise. I think Colonial showed that whatever you get back in terms of the technology they send back may not be reliable, but also the incentive structure is just off, right? I mean, in other words, you're just promoting this. The more companies that pay, I think one of the things. So in the last hour or 2 hours, the Wall Street Journal has reported the Colonial CEO has come out and admitted it, saying it was a difficult decision. I have three big points, and one is just a mysterious one is I can't answer yet, and I hate sounding like a conspiracy theorist, but so I'll just put it out there as a question so I sound less like a conspiracy theorist. I am still confused by why the company was closed down for that long. If in fact it was just related to billing, maybe that's true. But even in the Wall Street Journal article today, it is not at all clear whether the company had transparency on its impact and its operational impact.
Stay conspiratorial. What do you think may have been going on?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, did they know what was going on or anything? I think the idea that this was, you know, purely voluntary to shut down by the company sounds like a funny definition of voluntary. But the two things I want people to remember is, one, this was an attack on civilians. You know, we have a tendency to think like, oh, Colonial. This was an attack on Americans. Like, I hate being that person. Like, why is no one talking about my issue enough? But why is no one talking about my issue enough? This is why we do have to have a stronger legislation in terms of both what we require of companies, but I think starting to think about some global agreement as people are talking about, because critical infrastructure is different. But the thing that just, you know, that struck me in the Wall Street Journal article about the CEO is Colonial is making all these decisions by itself about something that's impacting, you know, millions of Americans. And that seems to me, you know, and he says, the CEO says something like, I thought it was the best thing for America. I was like, who voted you in to decide? And so I'm definitely getting harsher about this. So after Colonial, about the requirements to make companies fess up about what's going on.
I mean, that's part of the problem when a huge percentage of your infrastructure is owned by the private sector.
Yeah, 80%.
But can I challenge something you said a minute ago? You said, we're talking to Juliette Kayyem, that you know your position is you're against paying ransom to these companies. And my reaction to that is exactly the same reaction I have to the United States policy is you don't negotiate with hostage takers.
Yeah.
In the abstract, I 100% agree with the latter, and I 100% agree with you, until it's my kid and until it's my company that's going to get destroyed. And you say, what's the alternative for me? The alternative for me is I lose someone I love or I lose my business. And so I don't think it's that, again, in the abstract, it's not that easy.
No, it isn't. It isn't. And it's, you know, some of it may be calling their bluff. I mean, in other words, you know, the more that companies do challenge this, that this is not a tolerable, even cost of business, the more there'll be pushback. But I agree with you. And that's why I think there hasn't been legislation criminalizing it. I think to the average American, when you say, yes, companies are able to make these decisions. And remember, most of these hackers have at least some support by a foreign entity or working in countries with support. You know, you say to most Americans, yeah, you don't have to, if you're a company, you don't have to tell anyone and you can do it on your own. That seems kind of crazy. I should remind people, lest we think that this is just an American problem. You know, about 3 days later, a very troublesome hacker group shut down Ireland's health system for some period of time, its management database system. So this is getting really bad, and we need to have criminal prosecutions and things like that.
So Juliette Kayyem, I saw this headline, particularly coming in the National Review, which is a fairly conservative publication, and my heart leapt with joy. Army prioritizes climate change as serious threat to national security, talking about humanitarian disasters, you know, weak governments being undermined, all these economic disruptions, immigration crises.
Yeah.
So I'm thrilled that it seems like even the conservatives here or the people that have been climate change deniers are getting with the program.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that has been clear. I mean, mostly because the military is getting with the program. When you think of everything from international unrest to climate refugees to forced readiness. Right. So we think about our Navy is in the water and what is happening to our naval bases and also our Air Force bases that are impacted by hurricanes and tornadoes in places like Kentucky and Tennessee. That this is serious and that the intel is just absolutely clear in this regard. So you know, this is a lot like, I think, you know, and conservatives have been consistent with this. I think this is a lot like gun control, in which 90% of Americans sort of get what needs to be done. And then you just have a captured party unwilling to move forward. The difference with climate change, of course, is you are seeing a lot of activity in the private sector, local and state level. So you're not really as dependent on federal law as we are with gun control. And you know, on the other thing, on the conservative thing, Margaret, the money is in the green economy.
Renewable energy,
You know, I think that there is, that is, the money ain't in coal, people. I mean, the future of money is not in coal. So if you are someone who is looking at the market and that's driving your public policy decisions, you're not looking at coal. You are looking at ways in which you're capturing green, you know, alternative sources of energy and moving forward.
Well, I should say, by the way, to amend what I said before, I'm thinking of a side business either in green energy or in ransomware. I'm not clear
yeah,
which one.
You
I'm
can do choose. That, or in, yeah, or in intelligence gathering, or you know, there's all the things that are broken. But
Julia,
go ahead.
I'm sorry, we just have a minute left. I want to stay on the. I knew Marjorie would be thrilled, and so was I. Army mm-hmm. prioritizes climate change as a serious threat. In a minute, we have left. What does that mean operationally? Okay, we prioritize right. it. What do we do differently from what we did before in the Army?
So I think there's going to be a couple things, and I'm really excited by this if this moves forward. I think that there should be a disaster command. I think we're beginning to think about that, just a designated command that is looking at, you know, both to help countries stabilize after and assess potential threats. Mm-hmm. I think in particular, this is going to mean Pentagon resources are going to be put into alternative energy R&D, research mm-hmm. and development, which is always good to get Pentagon right. money. And then the third is we better get our forces and our military readiness prepared. Our Navy is, I mean, it is, you know, former President Trump would not allow there to be any review of our military readiness based on concerns about climate change. That has changed mm-hmm. already. When I think about the forces, the one I worry about the most is, of course, the Navy and our naval bases. And not just in the U.S. Think about Guam and other places.
Julia Kayyem, thank you very much. Great to talk to you.
Thank you, guys. We'll see what happens with our commission.
We will indeed. Well, there'll be a vote today on something.
That is correct. Julia Kayyem joins us every week.
See you later. You guys see you soon, I hope.
See you in, I hope in person soon. Julia Kayyem joins us.
I'm waiting for the email. I'll see you soon.
Okay. Julia is the former Assistant Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, Faculty Chair of the Homeland Security Program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, and an analyst for CNN. Julia, thanks again. Coming up, from cover-ups to crimes, how the Boston Police Department has let the Dennis Whites of the police force rise through the ranks. That conversation is next on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan. The cancel culture has come under a lot of criticism for being an easy way out of a complicated situation. However, in the case of the deeply troubled Boston Police Department, is it time to cancel its culture of cover-ups and to dismantle the blue wall of silence that has let the Dennis Whites of the force rise to power? A recent editorial in the Boston Globe says it is. Join us online to talk about this and other headlines is Bina Venkatraman. Bina is the editorial page editor of the Globe. Her latest book is The Optimist Telescope, Thinking Ahead in a Reckless Age. Bina, it's great to talk to you as always.
Great to talk to you, Jim. Hi, Marjorie.
Hey, great to talk to you too, Bina. Let's talk with start with the Boston Police. You know, you guys had a great editorial yesterday talking about the guy that was appointed commissioner by Walsh, of course, and then immediately that was delayed because of these allegations of domestic violence. Your editorial was White, meaning Dennis White, and the blue wall of silence must go. Today I opened up the op-ed page, and Renee Graham's got another great column saying the Boston Police Department's moral rot. So tell us what you're talking about.
Well, this is more than just one person. Of course, what we've learned from the investigators' report about Dennis White with these allegations of domestic abuse does not look at all good. It doesn't look like the kind of leadership you would want from folks who are supposed to ensure the public safety. It doesn't look like the kind of symbol you'd even want to send to the city. And why Marty Walsh so quickly, without proper vetting, pushed Dennis White into this position is very unclear still. But I think it's much deeper. What the investigators' report also showed was a total stonewalling of her efforts to try to understand what had happened in White's record as part of rebuilding public trust. Once I have to commend my newsroom colleagues in the Globe for releasing this part of White's record, which the Walsh administration had not. And once that revelation came out and the Walsh administration went through with this investigation, one would think that the idea would be to try to be a little more transparent about the background of this person, what had really happened between him and his former wife, what, you know, how can the public trust this person? How can the police, fellow police officers trust this person as their leader? But instead, you know, the report shows that the investigator, Tasmin Kaplan, was, you know, requested to interview about 21 officers, and only seven agreed with her investigation, cooperated with her investigation. So just this culture of sort of turning inward and putting up a wall instead of providing the information that would allow the public to actually feel that this the BPD is there to serve them and not about just closing in ranks the way they did with Patrick Rose, shielding him from real consequences, keeping him in leadership, keeping him on the force despite charges sustained against him for child molestation. This is a much deeper issue of culture at BPD, and I would say of a track record of mayors who've been unwilling to hold the BPD accountable, hold particular officers accountable, take on the provisions in union contracts that prevent adequate consequences for officers who abuse the badge, who abuse the law.
You know, we're talking to Bina Venkatrama, editorial page of the Globe. This is another one. You know, we're just talking to Juliet about Kevin McCarthy. It put me over the edge. This is putting me over the edge, too. I have a bunch of things to ask you about. One, when two-thirds of these people that Kaplan, the investigator, is pursuing, refused to cooperate, and apparently the interim or acting police commissioner spoke to the chief of staff of the mayor about it, all these people work for the acting mayor. Why didn't she order the acting commissioner to order members of his staff to cooperate with Kaplan? It's not just on them. She's the boss. Why didn't she order that, Bina?
Well, it's a good question, but if you look at part of this timeline, part of this timeline was under Marty Walsh and under Eugene Flaherty, the corporation counsel at the time. But it is a fair question, I think, of the acting mayor. You know, what has really gone on here? Why hasn't there been cooperation? Why hasn't there been an ability to sort of call forth, you know, at least more details to come forward. Now, one of the reasons might be that acting mayor Janey was interested in firing White based on what revelations were already there, right? It's almost like perhaps there was enough information, even with the stonewalling, to conclude that this is not the right guy to be the commissioner of the BPD. And the goal was to move on and name a new commissioner, which is, you know, generally the understanding that a lot of us have based on the events that happened last week. And that the idea was, you know, we should move on from this person. And now, of course, we know there's been legal action taken by Dennis White, you know, against the city. He doesn't think that his, you know, potential firing would be justified. And so this is dragging out. And that's why the Globe editorial board called on Dennis White to step down, to really resign, because this is not good for the city. It's not good for the Boston Police Department. It's not good for the public trust. It's certainly not good for the acting mayor, who, of course, is running for the real deal.
Marty, can I just get two more things in here to get them off so I don't explode?
Okay, go ahead.
We had Brian, McGraw, your colleague, on about a week or so ago, and I said to Brian that I thought that the Globe, this is not your editorial page, but in the news pages, should say to public officials on the public dime, if you don't speak to us about a critical issue, we're not publishing a statement. You can't get away with that anymore. I feel the same way about these investigators. Kaplan, who is the investigator, told us that, quote, the report speaks for itself. She won't discuss it, which is reminiscent of the guy that Charlie Baker hired to look into the Holyoke Soldiers Home.
That's the report, right.
After, what, 76 people died there or something, was presented by Charlie Baker, whose administration was being looked at by the investigator. And the investigator refused to talk to any media people about his work. So that's one thing. And one last thing, and then I'll really, we can move on if you want to, Marjorie. The thing that is most troubling to me, and I'll quote myself if I may, we wouldn't have known that Patrick Rose Sr., who was a cop for a couple of decades after being credibly accused of child molestation and rose to be union president, was likely a serial molester were it not for the Boston Globe. This wasn't the police policing themselves. We wouldn't have known everything we learned about Dennis White were it not for the Boston Globe. The police didn't police themselves. Bina, why should we think that there are not other Patrick Rose Sr.'s and Dennis White's who the Globe just hasn't gotten to yet, because there's no evidence the police themselves are going to out any of their fellow officers?
I think that's exactly the problem we're pointing to, that this is obviously, this is what we can see of the iceberg above the water, right, thanks to my newsroom colleagues who've been diligently going after this information. In fact, the Globe has sued for the right. Rose records and beyond. And so there's a real lack of both accountability and transparency about those who abuse the law, those who are not serving the public interest, who are not protecting public safety in these roles adequately, either because of their record or because of their behavior. And so it's absolutely fair for the public to be wondering, with all this smoke, what other fires mm-hmm. are there? And I think it's absolutely our job as journalists to be digging up these cases. But you have to wonder why it isn't in the self-interest of the mayor of the city, the acting mayor of the city, the Boston police, the leaders in the Boston police who want to do right by the public and protect the public, to make clear that this kind of behavior isn't acceptable. Absolutely. And to do what's right when these kind of investigations and issues surface. And that's why we think the culture is just so contaminated. And it's interesting you raised the Mark Pearlstein issue, the Holyoke investigator, because I think you're absolutely right. There's this sort of notion that that these people who are public servants, who get employed by the public, right, get employed by the state to investigate, employed by the city to investigate, areas of falling down on public duty by public officials, that they're not, that they don't somehow need to answer to the public directly. And I agree with you that there is something that is just really, I wonder if it's part of the carryover from the Trump era, where he just kind of stonewalled the press. And there's a new kind of culture of how public officials are interacting with the public and the press that I think we need to reverse.
But in fairness, this is sort of a symbiotic relationship, it seems to me, between a lot of politicians and police departments. We see this with the state police. The Globe has done great work on the state police. We see this with the Boston police. And one of your news reporters, Jim Puzangera, I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly. He must be a new reporter. I've not seen his name before. But he points out that the Massachusetts delegation, all Democrats, have been asked about Marty Walsh's failure to vet this Boston police commissioner. And according to this reporter, they have not come out to talk about this, nor have members of the House and Senate up at the State House. So one of the problems here is politicians don't want to antagonize the cops. And it's gone on forever. And it's mostly, well, I shouldn't say it's mostly Democrats in this case. I mean, Massachusetts is mostly Democrats, but I don't think Mitt Romney wanted to antagonize the cops, or Charlie Baker wants to antagonize the cops. So maybe it's a bipartisan not wanting to antagonize the cops.
Well, you have district attorneys, attorneys general, governors who are protected by state police. There's a real culture there. I think you're absolutely right. But it's not just about not wanting to antagonize the police. It's about the police unions. So none of these politicians want to take on the provisions in these police contracts at the city level that protect officers from being investigated for wrongdoing, from consequences when wrongdoing is found. And that is just, the state police reform bill here in Massachusetts that was just passed at the end of last year is going to do something about that. But at the end of the day, if you don't crack open that capacity to create consequences, as there are in so many other jobs, you know, so many other positions and that aren't even as closely related to protecting and interacting with the public and protecting public safety and being armed amongst civilians and citizens, so many higher bars in terms of what needs to be done when someone abuses that law or is violent or abuses that uniform. This is just really demanding a basic level of accountability, and it needs to start with politicians taking a much harder line on those police contracts. And, you know, we're in a mayoral election year, and I think Boston citizens need to be really, really tuned in to what these mayoral candidates are saying and what they're willing to really put on the line in terms of how they will take on these protective provisions that prevent our police from doing what their job is, which is, you know, protecting the public.
We're talking about being... Oh, I'm sorry, Jim.
Do you want to go right ahead.
I was just going to reintroduce our guest, Beenet Venkatraman. She's the editorial page editor of the Boston Globe. Her latest book is The Optimist Telescope, Thinking Ahead in a Reckless Age. Can we move on to a certain irony about the gun manufacturing in Massachusetts, Jim, or would you do something more on the cuffs?
I need an EMT, so okay. You two just continue.
Okay. You guys, you had a great editorial, Beenet, about this weird situation that we have so many gun laws restricting what we can do in Massachusetts. We have a very low gun fatality rate because of that. But we have Springfield-based Smith & Wesson making AR-15s. So what was your editorial about?
Well, we're essentially exporting death. Remember, these assault rifles have been used in all kinds of mass shootings, the Orlando nightclub shooting, Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting, which still, you know, it's hard not to think about that without feeling heartbroken anew every time. The Parkland School shooting in Florida. These assault rifles have no purpose in civilian life. They are basically killing machines. Massachusetts banned them here in 2004, yet we continue to manufacture them here in Massachusetts. Smith & Wesson in Springfield manufactures them and exports them for civilian use in other states. And the Globe editorial board is taking the position following the lead of California, as well as New York and New Jersey, though they have slightly different approaches to the law, in saying that we should ban the manufacture of these assault rifles here in the state. If they're too dangerous and toxic to be used here in Massachusetts, why are we allowing them to be manufactured and exported to other states?
You know, by the way, and I read the other day, John Rosenthal, managing Stop Handgun Violence, a relentless crusader, has been talking about this absurdity. I mean, the absurdity, you can't buy them or have them or sell them here, but you can manufacture them and sell them elsewhere. The state rep who represents the district where Smith & Wesson is, even though they're talking about loss of jobs, this Representative Williams, he supports this ban on the manufacture. Quick question, though. You addressed this in your editorial. Some people with whom we've discussed this say there are interstate commerce constitutional issues. You don't think there are, Beenet, correct?
Well, we talked to a number of legal scholars about this, and we also looked at what happened this similar law in New York, again, not identical to this, what this bill would do, has been challenged in the federal courts. And so far, it's been upheld by an appellate court. California's, I think, is going to endure a legal challenge, if not already. And so there is some question, right? There, you know, there's going to be challenges around this. But our conclusion in talking to experts about this was that this is not an infringement on interstate commerce. It's not saying that that something can't be shipped across state lines. It is actually saying that something can't be manufactured within the Commonwealth, within these state lines. So it's a bit of a distinction, and I think the courts will ultimately determine what can happen. But we know the harm created by these weapons, and it's so interesting to see what Colt did. Also, you know, West Hartford, New England manufacturer, around AR-15s, which is they decided they would stop manufacturing them for civilian use, right? They would only manufacture them for military and turn their production towards other kinds of guns that are, you know, can be used more recreationally or justifiably, you know, owned as handguns, not killing machines. And so that is something that Smith & Wesson could voluntarily do in anticipation of this bill if they wanted to actually to protect the public in this way.
So we're talking to Bina Venkatraman, editorial page editor of the Boston Globe. So you called these what cities and towns are doing when they before they allow marijuana shops to come in, municipal shakedowns. So please elaborate on your editorial about abusing marijuana money.
So this is so, I mean, it's almost entertaining. I can hear the laughter in your voice.
Yeah.
Host community agreements that Massachusetts towns are putting forth for cannabis, you know, companies are, you know, some of them are kind of the burdens they're putting on these pot shops, basically, to contribute to local charities, contribute thousands of dollars to the local American Legion. In Salem, they want the companies to help contribute to a study of the viability of a shuttle bus.
Yeah.
So there's some degree of, you know, sharing some of the revenue so that it goes back into community civic services. You know, these companies are going to pay taxes like other retail businesses in cities. So they'll still be supporting the cities. But these host community agreements as a provision of the law are really being taken to an extreme. And if you think about what the purpose of a lot of this law was, it was to create equity, right? To try to right the wrongs, allow entrepreneurs to profit from cannabis who might come from communities that were disproportionately criminalized around marijuana possession and sale. And so when you think about creating these hugely prohibitive barriers that make it so costly to run marijuana businesses in these towns, you're basically going to kind of end up shooting yourself in the foot in that sense, like of creating more barriers for entrepreneurs who might have a harder time. And you're going to favor companies that have, you know, chains or have the ability to pay more of these sort of, you know, side deals.
By the way, Mayor Correa just emailed in and he said, why didn't you write this editorial 3 years ago? Do you have an answer?
Oh, yeah. Hold on. We can't move. We must point out that Jaziel Correa, the mayor of my hometown, former mayor, that's right. He's no longer the mayor. I think he's going to face some serious consequences for this, which is convicted of extorting, allegedly, as you point out, $600,000 in bribes so he could take his girlfriend on helicopter rides around
Newport. Well, it's not allegedly anymore.
He's convicted. That's right. He's done it. Yeah. Helicopter rides around Newport, hotel, extravagant hotels in Washington, D.C., all these expensive jewelry, suits, unbelievable. So I think he stepped over the line just a tad,
Well, yeah, I mean, he made it a high criminal art, but even legally, right, what some of these towns are doing is a little bit over the top. But yeah, he certainly took it to an art form.
That's
well, there's
right.
a question as to what they're doing is legal, whether or not they're exceeding these things. And, you know, I'm sure you know who Kobe Evans is, who owns Pure Oasis, which I believe was the first recreational marijuana retailer granted a license under the equity provisions. And by the way, we say this every time we talk about this. This is not just a nice idea embraced by high-minded people. This is in the statute that was voted for by the people of Massachusetts. This equity language is baked in to the law in the state. Kobe's position is these, and I don't want to speak for him, but I will because he said it to us a number of times, that these community host agreements are so have such potential for abuse and to keep small entrepreneurs out and only allow the big boys who are loaded with funds in, that they should eliminate them completely. Why shouldn't it, as you say, they'll get a ton of money from the existence of the retailer in that community. Why should they exact any financial benefit during the licensing process? Let them be judged on other issues, but not upon a payment. What's wrong with that notion, Bina?
Well, at the very least, there should be some sort of cap. I think that the rationale that some of these communities are using is to say that, you know, these businesses are different than businesses that sell ice cream. And so there's some need for revenue to support community development in other ways, because there might be some harms around them in terms of, you know, they have a notion of the kind of people who would be frequenting them or the kind of people who would be gathered mm-hmm. around them. But it's really hard when you look at that and then you compare it to liquor stores or bars, right? Is there really something that special about these retailers mm-hmm. that requires or that justifies, right, this kind of level of, you know, share 3% of your revenue with us, plus make $10,000 donations to local charities. Not that donating to local charities isn't a good thing, but as you said, it definitely goes against the spirit and the letter of this law with respect to equity when you make the barrier so high that the only kinds of companies that would be able to do this would not be homegrown community entrepreneurs, but potentially folks who already have really lucrative chain businesses that maybe aren't, that maybe aren't the kind of people who we want to see benefit from this, which is really, in a way, a kind of restorative justice.
Yes, it is.
Kind of approach to what's happened in this country with the criminalization of people who have smoked pot and had pot in their possession, maybe sold a little bit of it, but have been heavily punished for that.
Well, you know, one last thing. We only have a minute left. I mean, the answer to your question is why is it treated differently? It's because reefer madness is still alive and well amongst politicians. We've discussed in the show three times the voters on decriminalization originally, then another ballot question X number of years later on legalization of medical marijuana, then recreational marijuana a few years after that. In every instance, virtually every single politician was on the other side from the people of Massachusetts.
And the police.
And in most cases went out of their way to delay implementation even after the people had voted and made their sense clear. So, again, I'm glad you wrote about it, and I think there needs to be a lot of reform thinking on the part of the legislature now that the industry is sort of, in place.
Well, these kinds of, I'm sure you want to move on soon, but these kinds of cultural attitudes towards drugs, you know, do change and affect how we, you know, how we're able to move forward.
Absolutely.
And I just think about now the research centers that are being opened, including at Mass General on psychedelics and how mm-hmm. they're finding these links between particular substances like psilocybin and being able to address severe PTSD and depression, and how for decades that research, that scientific medical research, was really thwarted by these cultural attitudes towards drugs that came out of the war on drugs. It's not to say that there aren't harms of these substances when unchecked, right, unleashed, mm-hmm. and they're very different kinds of drugs that we're talking about. But I do think you're right. Change is really slow, and I think often these social attitudes that get developed and political stances that develop out of them really can thwart progress in ways that we have to be aware of.
Pina, we always enjoy talking to you. Thanks so much for your time.
Yeah. Thanks so much. Great to talk to you, too.
Thank you. Pina Venkatraman is the editorial page editor of the Boston Globe. Her latest book, The Optimist Telescope, Thinking Ahead in a Reckless Age. Thanks again to Pina Venkatraman. Coming up, the United States finally decides to share its vaccine wealth with the rest of the world. We're going to talk to our medical ethicist about vaccines, about opening up. We're going to talk to him about UFOs, a lot of great stuff with Art Kaplan coming up on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Marjorie Egan, Jim Browdy. With a new conservative majority, the Supreme Court is eyeing the end of Roe v. Wade by way of an abortion ban case in Mississippi, which would completely ban abortions after 15 weeks with no exceptions for victims of sexual assault. Depending on the ruling, it could affect the health and well-being of women, teenagers, and girls in states throughout the country. Joining us on the line to talk about this, if Rochelle Walensky is on the fast track to becoming the next Deborah Birx, and other medical headlines is Art Kaplan. Art is a Drs. William F. and Virginia Connolly Mitty professor and founding head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU School of Medicine in New York City. And looks like he has a boys regular today. I believe that is the haircut in question. Is that correct, Art Kaplan?
Prepared to wander the hills and vales of Connecticut in my lightweight hairdo. Yes,
I love it. You
forget,
look fabulous,
forget
by
the
way.
Boys regular. Look at the background on Art Zoom. He's got in front of a beautiful live. House with a beautiful lawn. We're very impressed, Art Kaplan. Let me tell you.
There you go. This is life in the Connecticut suburbs.
Yeah, well, Connecticut's a beautiful state. So, all right, let's ask about Rochelle Walensky, the head of the CDC. She's taken a hit in a seeming to do a complete about face on mask wearing, non-mask wearing, practically overnight. So, is this her fault, or should they have done this better, or what do you think?
Well, I'll ask you, Marjorie. So, what is the mask policy?
The mask policy seems to be everybody can take off their masks, whether you're vaccinated or not vaccinated. I guess that's the policy, except in certain exceptions.
Well, that may be the reality. I think the policy is if you're vaccinated, you can take your mask off outdoors, and then there are certain circumstances where you have to be cautious, even if you're vaccinated indoors. But the way this message got heard, the way it was rolled out was, mask off,
right.
We're all done. Ollie, Ollie, in free. What was that old?
Oh, yes, that was it. When you played hide and seek as a kid.
Exactly. So it was like, okay. So I think this message was handled in a terrible manner. I think they flipped from being tough about masking to giving a message that seemed to be no masking and would be interpreted by non-vaccinators as, well, I'm going to not mask too because I can, and I'm not going to fess up to the fact that I'm not vaccinated. So bad messaging. I think she didn't do a good job on this rollout and didn't coordinate it with the state, county, city officials so that everybody would be on the same page. There were just a lot of people who were like, what is it? What are we supposed to do? What's the message? And that's no good. You can't.
By the way, I don't want to revisit a painful topic, but since you brought it up, I couldn't play hide and seek as a kid because I couldn't fit into anything to hide. So, but that's a whole other kettle of fish. You know, Art, you're talking about the messaging being confusing. The other thing she's criticized for, and by the way, for those of you who don't know, she's an MGH alum,
right,
and I assume will return shortly after her stint with the federal government. 2 days before, a day and a half before, she's testifying strongly in front of Congress defending the masks when the Washington Post reports that the people at the CDC were working on the announcement to be given a day and a half later about no masks. I saw on Chris Cuomo on CNN about 12 hours before, maybe 16 hours before the change in mask policy, whether it's clear or not. And she yet again, in the face of tough questions from Cuomo, is defending the mask policy. So my sense of this, and she obviously is a brilliant doctor and knows her stuff, I think what you find is somebody who really hasn't had this kind of position before. She's been a leading doc in a major hospital. But to go to this front and apparently giving short notice to the Biden administration, it sounds like it was not only handled horribly, but gives fuel to the crazies who want to undercut the credibility of science and experts in this country.
Well, you're partly right, Jim, although let's give some credit. She's doing better than Deborah Birx.
Well, that's a hell of an endorsement. Thank you.
Oh, God.
We at least haven't had the silent endorsement of bleach or
exactly
other Trumpian oddities. No, I don't know the woman. People who do say she's great, very
smart.
So
I hear that, too.
You basically got to coordinate the agency effort. You got to do rollouts in a very careful, systematic way, because there are just all sorts of folks waiting in the bushes to jump you if you don't get it right. The conspiracy people, and it's a hoax, and we never needed to wear masks in the first place, and so they're having a good time with this thing being not clearly understood. I'm going to say this: people who kept saying to me, "Well, it's kind of the honor system. Do you think the unvaccinated people are going to wear masks?"
No.
Are you kidding me?
They're the last people are going to wear masks.
Yeah.
Right.
If they didn't
vaccinate, they're not going to run around wearing a mask. So, I don't know. My advice would still be, if you're indoors in very close quarters, keep the mask and do the social distancing, even if you're vaccinated for now. We'll see how that goes. And I also think this change in policy was too soon. We were getting closer to large-scale herd immunity, getting a lot of people vaccinated. My state, Connecticut, was up around 70%. We're getting there. And then they, I think the timing of this was like a month early.
Well, yeah, let me add to what you just said. It also, Marjorie said this, I think, on the air yesterday or the day before, is it totally destroyed the whole incentive program. Because the whole notion was to give people incentives to get vaccinated. As of last Friday with this announcement, it's all bets are off. You can pretend you're vaccinated if you choose.
You know who's one of my favorite people, except for you, of course, Art Kaplan, on this whole subject.
And me?
And Jim, absolutely brilliant, Jim, course, every day, is Lena Wen, the physician that we see on CNN so often. Uh-huh. And I love when she says, you want perks for the vaccinated. So that is why I was so happy to read this story. I'd never heard of these people before, this HIMSS health conference. Mm-hmm. I guess it's one of the largest health conferences in the industry. But that's why I was so thrilled to learn that the people that run this thing in Las Vegas have decided that everybody there, attendees, exhibitors, everybody that's there has to show proof of vaccination. And that's the kind of thing Lena Wen was talking about, saying, you can go to the theater, everybody just has to be fully vaccinated. You can go to the symphony, everybody has to be fully vaccinated. That's how you open up the economy.
Well, forget Lena. How about me? I've been whining about this for
Well, that's right. I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
It's like, come on. You got to give them a reason to get vaccinated. You get privileges. You get access. I think what that conference is doing is great. I think Dr. Wen is absolutely right. You know, you should provide reasons to get vaccinated, privileges, and one other thing that we don't seem to have been able to do, which is beyond me, could we like have an agreed upon proof of vaccination card?
Right.
I mean, way to say, yeah, this isn't a counterfeit or this isn't a phony or, you know, you're showing it, but you didn't have your second shot.
Well, let me ask you, but I want to ask you about that. That was on my list. Marjorie mentioned the Las Vegas big health conference. There's a huge health conference in October in Boston that's also requiring vaccination. And to prove it, they're using something a clear capital CLEAR health pass. What is that?
That's the same thing you use, some people use at the airports to get through customs quickly. It's the same company. You have to pay for it. It's not going to be around for the poor, probably not for the middle class, a couple $100, I believe, but it's not free. But it's a private company that basically is hitching back up to your doctor's office and saying, did they really get vaccinated? Well, why isn't the government doing that? I'll tell you why. Because the crazies in Washington don't want them to, so Biden yielded. But again, now we've got a bad mask policy and we got a bad vaccine certification policy, and that's bad.
I'm with you.
So, Art Kaplan, let's talk a little bit about the Supreme Court taking up this Mississippi abortion case, which is banning abortions after 15 weeks. One of the points they make, and they do have a point in this, is that viability since 1973 has changed somewhat. Well, I'm asking you if it's changed somewhat, that Roe v. Wade in 73 was decided that 24 weeks is viability and the child cannot survive or the fetus cannot survive, whatever you want to call this, outside the womb. Now, of course, you hear stories regularly, not that these babies are in great shape, but you read stories about babies born at 22 weeks, 23 weeks, and surviving. So,
Mississippi is saying 15 weeks.
Well, yes. 15 weeks is not real.
And there is no way that any fetus survives outside the body at 15 weeks, and it's for a very simple reason. The lungs don't develop till about 22 or 23 weeks, so no fetus can breathe. Before that, it's in the amniotic fluid, it's floating around inside mom, and it's got a weird chemical way to get oxygen into the fetus. So it is true, there's been a shift probably from 24, maybe at the extreme, to 22 weeks, but nobody has an artificial lung or an artificial womb for fetuses. So Mississippi's wrong. It's not close to 15 weeks. If it's shifted since the original Roe versus Wade line on viability at 24 weeks, it might have moved to 22 weeks, but until lungs develop, there's nothing you can do in a neonatal ICU to save a premature fetus.
So what I'm asking, though, I just want to be clear that the Supreme Court can't come up with 22 weeks.
Of course they can.
Well, that's what I'm wondering.
Of course they can.
Could they say
Well, they could. They'd just be pushing the biological facts.
Okay.
I mean, they could draw the line, I guess, wherever they wanted.
There's no need for the voting rights provision anymore either, Marjorie, even though everybody who was sane in America said there was. They're not bound by anything.
Well, I just want their lawyers, not physicians, so I wondered
if
they could.
If you're going to argue the facts,
right,
then it did not shift to 15 weeks.
Okay.
That's just not true. That's absolutely not true. The other argument running there, Marjorie, is that the fetus can feel pain at 15 weeks. Well, that's not true either, and we know that because the nervous system and the attachment of the brain to the nervous system isn't done by 15 weeks. So whatever your views on abortion, no fetus is viable at 15 weeks. No fetus could feel pain at 15 weeks, to put it bluntly. Its nervous system isn't connected. It isn't fully together yet. So if you want to make those claims, I would hope that these lawyers would say your facts are wrong and you can't make the change you want. But, you know, they're lawyers, so I guess, you know, they could do whatever they want.
I'll make a
prediction. I think this case is going to fail. It's getting a lot of attention, but I think the facts are blatantly wrong. But we're going to get to talk about 10 or 15 more cases that are coming down the pike to restrict abortion this year. This is just the first of a parade.
I hope you're right, but I have to say I'm no expert in either the science or the court. I'm not sure they would have taken a case if their intention was to leave Roe v. Wade exactly where it was. Let me just say one more thing, which is probably obvious to most of our listeners. The good news for maybe half the people in this country is they may live in a state where even without Roe v. Wade, they're protected. Places like Connecticut and Rhode Island and Massachusetts, which have either laws or constitutional protections or both.
There's more than 20 of them.
New Hampshire, is it?
Yeah.
But there are also a handful of states, at least 10, which have a trigger mechanism where automatically, if Roe v. Wade is undone, then whatever abortion protections exist in their state are undone with it. So it's one of these things where where you live and your ability to travel to one of those states with protection, which obviously poor people are going to have a hard time, poor women are going to have a hard time doing, is going to create yet another, you know, divided America.
Well, next door to us in New Hampshire, according to the Center for Reproductive Rights, abortion would likely remain legal but could be under threat because there are no express legal protections for
right.
it in you know, our neighbor, New Hampshire.
By the way, one other thing. We've talked about this long before COVID. About 40% of abortions now are medical, not surgical, not in a clinic. So you take a pill, and that can be done within the first, week of realizing that you're pregnant. But they've tried to broaden out the law to allow any doctor to prescribe it so you wouldn't have this fight over abortion clinics. And telemedicine, you can start to ship, and this gets into a tough issue for critics of abortion because they want to prohibit the shipping of that medicine over state lines, but then you wind up prohibiting the shipping of a lot of medicines over state lines. So we'll see how that unfolds, too. I think the future, if you know another prediction, chemical abortion is going to replace surgical abortion. Surgical abortion will probably be restricted somewhat, but we didn't have chemical abortion when Roe versus Wade was done way back in the 70s.
I want to just make one more point that Marjorie has made brilliantly about 100 times on the show.
Thank you, Jim.
Is if they do what we fear the Supreme Court will do on this, it may be the first time in the nation's history that the Supreme Court of the United States established a basic right for the people of this country and then took it away. I mean, I asked Renee Landers, a constitutional law expert, last night on TV, if she could think of one comparable situation where it was created by the Supreme Court, as it was in 73 with Roe v. Wade, under the right to privacy, and then take it away. It's unconscionable. We're talking Art Kaplan. Art, so you're at odds with 6,000 doctors in Tokyo. 6,000 doctors in Tokyo passed a resolution saying, cancel the Olympics. We can't do it safely. Art Kaplan wrote a piece, and we've talked about this before. You think, well, one, you think it's unavoidable, it's going to go on, but you also think the way to have it go on safely is to mandate vaccinations for all the athletes, because you think that, well, you'll explain why in a minute. But the IOC is not on board. In fact, from what I understand, they're actually discouraging any kinds of injections for whatever their drug policies are. So defend yourself, if you would. Make your case.
In English or Japanese?
Okay, anything you choose.
So look, the doctors are probably right. It doesn't make sense to bring the world to the doorstep of Japan with a 2% vaccination rate for
that's
the country
unbelievable.
Of Japan. And a healthcare system that's starting to tip. because they're getting too many patients. But the Japanese government and the IOC are plodding ahead. This is going to go. It's too late to call for the cancellation or the postponement. I mean, we could try a postponement. Remember, it was postponed once.
Yep.
But it's money, money, money that's driving this thing at this point. So what I learned from my work with the NCAA on the COVID committee I was on with them is you've got to do three things. Vaccinate everybody in sight, athletes, coaches, trainers, fans, anybody who's getting anywhere near an Olympic site in Japan, or the competitive sites that are in many countries to qualify for the Olympics where they're going right now. You got to do it now. And then make sure that you quarantine, and then make sure that you make, as soon as you're done with your competition, you get out of that village. You
yeah.
might be able to pull it off, but if you're going to vaccinate, you know what you got to do? You got to do it right now because it's what the Olympics is July. What are we in, May 19? You got to
yeah.
do this now.
You know, Art, one of the things I don't understand about the Japanese story is they have really done a terrific job of keeping down the number of infections and deaths. Why have they been so skillful on that and so unskillful, for lack of a better expression, at vaccinations?
The vaccination story for Japan is cultural. They have their own views about bodily purity and putting things into their body with vaccines. So it's just different from us. And the other thing is they did try the lockdowns and they did try the quarantines, but like Taiwan and Singapore, new variants appeared and began to spread again. So it undercut them. But yeah, they got their own vaccine phenomena, not at all like the vaccine resistance here. It's unique to Japan. But be that as it may, vaccinate now everybody in sight that you're going to let anywhere near that Olympics. Or, you know, they're inviting like 200 countries with multiple sports into the country, and a lot of them are coming from places that are having bad outbreaks, Brazil, India. Boy, geez.
So, Art Kaplan, let's move on to the subject we're going to talk about with our listeners in just a few minutes, whether or not we're rooting for these UFOs to really be UFOs, investigating us from planets far out and other galaxies, light years away and all that kind of stuff. Been all sorts of talk about sightings all over the place, and 60 Minutes did a segment on this. So I didn't know you were into UFOs, but I understand you'd, you'd like to address the subject of these UFO sightings. What do you think, Art?
Well, I got into them through my interest in alien surgeries upon various people when they were abducted, the ethics of informed consent. And
that's right.
How do the aliens have the right forms? No, I mean, I'm not into UFOs. It's just part of the science health end of the spectrum, the science end, if you will. And I think it's really interesting that UFOs have bubbled up because we're in the age of conspiracy. We're in the age of the fringe. And so things that used to be just dismissed as nutty, you know, you put this next to Matt Gaetz, and UFOs look pretty good. It's like, UFOs, okay, yeah.
Are you doubting, in all seriousness, these guys, I didn't see the 60 Minutes thing, but I read about it. They're making the case pretty strongly that these are real. Are you suggesting
I absolutely believe that there are unexplained aerial phenomena, that there's a percentage of them that you don't know what they are. But then you sort of ask, if these things have been flying around us for 100 years, no contact, they don't want to talk to us, they just zip around and scare people who are like out spooning in the middle of country.
How do you know
roads?
There hasn't been contact? You don't
Wait
believe in pod people?
Hold on.
Well, that's
Art Kaplan, literature and movies has taught us that the aliens have arrived here, and you know what always happens? It follows the same scenario.
Yep.
They arrive, and then the persons that they come into contact with are beamed up and probed.
And probed, yeah.
Yes.
A lot of people want to be probed, Marjorie.
If the aliens are here and they don't want to talk to us, then I don't care.
Okay.
That's my point. I just don't care. If they're just going to probe us and put us back, who cares if they're here?
Really?
It's like, you know, it's just like another phenomena background noise. They're not talking to me. They're not improving my lot. They're not doing anything. They're just buzzing us.
Okay, let's be clear, Art.
I don't care.
Do you want to be or do you not want to be beamed up and probed?
Again.
I would be against being probed. I don't trust
That's one of
anybody
us.
Who wants to probe me, alien or human.
You know, one last
Maybe
thing about this.
A colonoscopy.
This.
That's about as far as I'm going.
Okay.
We're all three of us of a certain age. For
yes,
younger
we are.
Listeners, I don't know if they still have this at the supermarket checkout with a cashier. When we were a little bit younger, all of the National Enquirer, all those kind of things.
That's right.
They'd have a picture
News
with an alien
world.
Looking
alien.
Like Dan Aykroyd as a conehead, sitting with like Jimmy Carter in the Oval Office discussing foreign policy.
That's right.
And they were selling like hotcakes.
You forgot the other forerunner to today's bioethics discussions. Does anybody remember Bat Boy, the genetically engineered little bat creature that ran around
yes.
and created havoc? He was like a Yeti type figure
really?
Of the past.
We actually have him on next Tuesday,
I
believe.
Why are aliens just buzzing us for, let's say, 60 years of observed reports, just looking at us? If we're just a zoo, then I'm going to come back and say again, I don't care. There's nothing in it for
it
me.
It could be a zoo. That's true. They're gathering evidence. They're planning.
They're patient.
They're planning their how they're going to
address
us.
Super genius races take 60 years to figure out what they're going to do with it.
Or hundreds. Who knows?
Yeah.
Art, it's a pleasure as always.
Art Kaplan,
well,
thank you very much.
I'm going to go back. I'll get my telescope out and start observing carefully again.
Okay.
Be well,
Art
Kaplan. We'll talk to you soon.
Joins us every week. He's the Drs. William F. and Virginia Conley Mitty, professor and founding head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU School of Medicine in New York City. Thanks a lot, Art Kaplan. Coming up.
Well, wait a second. Make clear again at the end of the show. We're going to end
That's
the show
right.
taking people's calls.
Right after we talk with Jared Bowen, GBH Executive Arts Editor. He's up next. We're going to take all your calls on UFOs, and you can weigh in on whether or not you want to be beamed up and probed.
Or have been.
That's right. But first, GBH Executive Arts Editor Jared Bowen with the latest on Arts and Culture Rundown. Jared is next on 89.7 GBH.
Public Radio, Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan, GBH's executive arts editor, who, by the way, has not been beamed and probed and is not happy about it, is here with the latest rundown of the arts and culture events in and around town. I did that for Marjorie. Jared Bowen also hosts the TV series Open Studio, which you can get Friday nights on GBH2. Hello there, Jared.
I don't even know how to start talking.
I wouldn't if I were you.
I just reiterate that we're going to be asking people if they've been beamed and probed coming up on our next segment after we talk to you, Jared. But we're not going to talk to you about that because we're going to talk to you about, of course, what else? Arts and culture around town. Jared and I in the studio together, Jim. We are here, the fully vaccinated in the studio.
It's a beautiful thing.
I just want to point that out. Mm. Anyway, what's going on, Merrimack Rep?
Yeah, this is a new show at Merrimack Repertory Theater that just began streaming, and it's streaming through May 30th. It's called A Woman of the World, and it's a one-woman show presented by Denise Cormier. She plays Mabel Loomis Todd, quick history lesson, especially a Massachusetts history lesson. She was somebody who lived here in Massachusetts in Amherst in the late 1800s, early 1900s. Who else lived in Amherst in that time?
Was it Emily?
Yes, Emily Dickinson. She lived right next door. This is a true story. And so Mabel Loomis Todd was somebody who was very much ahead of her time in terms of thinking, what she wanted to do, what she wanted to be as a woman. And she became very entwined with the Dickinson family, established a relationship with Emily Dickinson, but only through closed doors. Emily Dickinson, history tells us, never really left her room for outsiders, for people who weren't her family. And so established this relationship so that after Emily Dickinson died, Mabel Loomis Todd published what she described as the definitive collection of poetry.
You know, I never heard of her. And
Nor
as the story
I.
points out, she was the first to edit and the first to publish.
And so she became a very scandalous figure for that because some people appreciated the fact that she was essentially the one who introduced Emily Dickinson's poetry to the world, while others thought that she was using Dickinson as a way to boost her own fame and her own celebrity and and really ran with that, because this play takes place under the guise that we're at her island in Maine that she was able to buy through speaking tours and whatnot later on. And she's telling us about her life, which is something that she went on to do. She was very famous on the speaking circuit. So she takes us through that meeting with Emily Dickinson. She takes us through her sexual adventures. She was quite ahead of her time, I think, maybe even for this time in terms of that time period. But also kind of the regrets that she had for the way she was treated.
You know, I never heard of this woman either. And when I've read about her in the last 24 hours, I love this story.
Yes,
as I
great.
Think you made clear, she didn't know Dickinson. Her connection was a long affair. I guess she had been beamed and probed by the poet's married older brother. This guy, Austin, can never get enough beam and probe talk, I guess. But by the brother of Emily Dickinson. Did you know about this woman, Jared, before the play?
Well, I did, because as I was watching the play, I remembered going out years ago. You can tour Emily Dickinson's home out there in Amherst, and you can also tour the house next door. And I remember going on that tour. This is where Todd lived. And they kind of described, for what they knew at the time, how the arrangement of this relationship between Todd and Austin Dickinson and others all kind of happened with back staircases and whatnot, because Austin Dickinson was married. Marjorie is just looking at me. I'm trying to be so careful right now.
I wouldn't be if I were you.
Just thinking, is there room to a back staircase
Marjorie,
to be beamed and probed? I'm not sure. Sorry.
I am not talking.
Sorry.
But Jared, you don't understand. When you're doing the show, as you often do, and Marjorie gets into something, the goal to make her happy is to mention it 30 times during the 3 hours.
Sorry,
audience is sick of it, it makes Marjorie happy.
But I just want to ask you one question about this. Is worth a tour, the Emily Dickinson house and the house next door?
Oh, absolutely. And for the reason that I just said, too, because I realize how much it stayed with me, so that years later when I'm watching this piece, which, by the way, is a very strong piece. It's such a great, compelling character study. And to learn this history... But yeah, for me to be able to associate, I even kind of remember the wallpaper in that home. So immediately puts you into that scene and that time.
You know, before you leave it, I assume this is virtual. Correct me if I'm wrong, but where is the Merrimack Rep company based?
It's in Lowell.
Lowell. Okay, yep. Great. Okay. So a mass art comes to Soho, one of my favorite areas of the city. What's that deal about?
Yeah, this is a really exciting project. I am so proud of Massachusetts College of Art and Design. What they've done over the last year, again, taking downtime to the extent that they have downtime, because, of course, they kept classes going. But they came up with this pilot program to open a gallery space in SOA. For people who don't know, that's the kind of hot art and design district in Boston.
Great.
You can go down there on the weekends for the big fairs that they have for food and craftspeople and artists. And a lot of the art galleries are located down there. And so they have opened this new gallery called Mass Art SOA. And for their inaugural exhibition, it's the thesis projects of the 8 graduate students from Mass Arts Fine Arts program this year. And the thesis project is, of course, the work that they've been doing all this year. It's the culmination of their fine arts studies. And so from my standpoint, I felt like we were getting the first introduction to the newest, freshest voices who are coming out in the art world as they launch into the world, and we get to have this public engagement with them. From Mass Art's standpoint, they get to educate these students about what it's like to move, and not all will go into gallery spaces, not all will trade in that kind of realm, but they grow up and they get put out, and they have people who come and see their shows. A couple of the artists I talk to, they like to kind of stand back and listen or even engage with patrons to have an understanding of what they think of their work. And the greatest part of this is that it's all different kinds of work. So you have one artist who is really, his name is Jesus Pizarro. He's contending with the last year of the pandemic. He contracted coronavirus. He was waylaid by it, suffered from mental health issues, and you see that all rendered in his work. There's another artist I spoke with, Sarah Hull, and she told me she's always been distracted. And in her case, it's a good thing, because she'll be walking down the street and she'll catch the way the leaves leave a certain shadow or the color of the shadow on the street. She's really consumed with aerial views. So you see a lot of her looking down at the world and how she contracts those and abstracts those views in her paintings from work that she's done both up here and then in Tampa, Florida, by going up to big hotels and looking down.
You know, Mass College of Art has its main campus on Huntington Avenue, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And don't they have a big space on the first floor there for a lot of artwork that you can go in and see? I don't know if that's open.
It's not open. I keep I'm really trying to push the college museums to reopen. I understand that they have a great conflict here because they want to keep their students safe. But at the same time, first of all, most of them are free, as is the Mass Art Art Museum. But they have great exhibitions and shows, and they had just opened their new museum when the pandemic hit. So I think as soon as they can deem it safe, and actually since I was last with them, of course, we have the governor's announcement, so hopefully it'll be soon.
You know, before we get to something that sounds fabulous to me, this Huntington thing called Black Bean Project. It sounds really terrific. Is this May 29th thing, the governor, I'm assuming everything, I mean, obviously shows can't materialize when they weren't planned before last Friday's announcement, but essentially entertainment is at 100% capacity starting on the 29th of May, Jared Bowen?
It is. And so I think what we're seeing now is the Berkshires anticipated that they would be able to go ahead in some capacity by having outdoor performances. So they'll be ready to be up and running, do outdoor performances, set to go. And then the more local theaters like the Huntington Theater Company, Lyric Stage Company just yesterday announced their season starting in September. As we talked, Broadway and Boston had already announced a season starting in November. I think they all felt comfortable to start moving forward when the vaccinations came. So now they will be fully prepped for the regular theater season that usually starts late summer to come back and just be ready to go. All the contracts will be in place, sets will be built, and they'll be ready to go.
Yeah, that is, you know, I should have obviously thought of this, but this is going to mean great things right very soon for like live music venues and stuff like that, right?
Absolutely. I think they'll be careful to start. What I'm starting to hear is that you'll see shorter shows. You might see more one-person shows, mm-hmm. probably less singing at the beginning. You'll see intermission-less shows so that people aren't congregating as long as they might have been. And then we'll start to ease through it. The ART also has just announced that they'll be doing an outdoor piece at the Arnold Arboretum. It's called the Arboretum Experience with sound and visuals, a self-guided tour that they're producing. That'll happen later in the summer. So it's exciting. It's really exciting to have everyone back.
You know, by
back.
The way, let me just say selfishly, for those people like me who like to go to bed by about 8:15 every night, no intermission is going to be a great thing for so let's get back to this Huntington thing, which from what I've read,
beans.
I cannot wait to see. Black Beans Project, tell us.
Yeah, this is really enjoyable, too. It's funny, we just talked about A Woman of the World, and now this piece, two pieces I really liked in streaming, and now we're probably bounce out of streaming and back into real life. That said, a lot of them will still carry the online component just for accessibility reasons. But the Black Beans Project is a piece that was created by Melinda Lopez and Joel Perez. And they play these siblings, Mariana and Henry. And there's a kind of an age difference, so that allows her to kind of be the bossy one in the family. And he's a little bit more freewheeling. But they come together over Zoom to make their recently deceased mother's Cuban black bean recipe. By the way, you can go on the Huntington website and get an actual great black bean recipe.
Well,
so you
great.
Can cook along with them. And they're actually cooking. They're talking. And I just thought this piece was beautifully crafted as you have this exchange between these siblings that goes from how are you doing, how are you doing, to diving into those deeper existential issues of what it means to have lost a parent, what it means to be in cancel culture, what it means to have a relationship fall apart. And so it's just, I thought it was really sweet. And the fact that these two actors and writers have collaborated before, that chemistry really comes through so that it becomes this really choice embodiment of family.
You know what I love? That the mother and daughter had this game they called Secretos for Secrets, where a mother would tell the daughter all her secrets and the daughter would tell the mother. It was a brilliant way to get your kid to tell you stuff that they never would otherwise tell you, I thought.
That made me wonder how many times I fell for that without realizing it.
No, we have a clip from this Black Beans Project from the Huntington Theater, so let's hear a little sound.
All of my garlic and onions are chopped.
No, that's not enough garlic.
What?
You need más ajo. Más ajo. Look at how much I have.
Okay.
Chop it finer.
How's that, Julia, child?
Yeah.
It's
I mean, it
line.
Is a great idea, though, because who doesn't remember fondly some of their mother's recipes? Maybe not Jim. I know that perhaps
No, let
you
me
don't.
Tell you, and that's not fair. This one, my mother could boil a hot dog better than anybody. No, serious, better than anybody. I have ever known. Well, she's good-hearted anyway.
The last time maybe you were talking about your mom and food, I was listening in the car. And so, yeah, I wonder what those recipes smell like, what she sent you to bed with. I nearly
drove off
the
road. For those who missed that show, I would go to bed every night. This is true right before I went to bed, in bed. I would get a Hebrew National salami on white bread with a little extra slab of salami on top. It was really good for your health right before you go to sleep. But again, well-intentioned. We're talking to Jared Bowen. So from the Huntington to the McMullen Museum, B.C., what's going on there, Jared Bowen?
Okay, this is something I think that you know I don't say very often, but this is a stop what you're doing, get your tickets now experience. So this is a show. McMullen Museum of Art is Boston College's museum. And they actually have done what I've been imploring museums to do. Because the students are gone now, they've been able to open up this show through June 13th. So just a few weeks for the general public to come and see this show. You have to reserve your tickets online. But the show is called Taking Shape, Abstraction from the Arab World, 1950s to the 1980s. The reason I am so excited, aside from this art being absolutely extraordinary, I actually went to the show twice. That's how much I have loved this show, is the fact that we are seeing something, a whole range of art that few people outside of the Arab world have seen before, because popular narrative holds that people like Picasso in Europe and Jackson Pollock in the United States, they were the people who were driving our art forward in the latter half of the 20th century, kind of blowing up everything that had come before. But this is a show that argues there was so much happening in the Arab world. And by the way, they acknowledge it's kind of a contentious title, because this is a world that stretches from North Africa to West Asia, all demographics, all religious beliefs. But here you have, you know, this 30 years of art, of artists who came out of these countries, which, by the way, were independent nations, fledgling independent nations, as decolonization happened in the Middle East and Africa. And they started to interact with people all over the world. And then they would come home after studying with people like Picasso or those groups. And then they would mine their own cultures and their histories, looking at textiles, Mesopotamian artifacts, tapestry, metalwork, jewelry. And they would infuse their own takeaway from other elements, or often it was their own original elements, with their cultures. So you have this gorgeous art, and as I say, it's never been seen before, because it all comes from the collection of one man who's founded the Barjeel Foundation in the United Arab Emirates. And the Barjeel Art Foundation, it's his mission just to collect this art and start telling these stories. He's also collected, he's gone out of his way to collect a lot of women who often were overlooked in these periods. And so this is the beginning of academics and scholars and curators beginning to tell the story of how this art was created and who these artists were.
And you know what else, too? I think a lot of people don't even realize that the McMullen Museum is there. It's where the Cardinal used to live on Commonwealth Avenue up by Boston College.
Yep.
Yes.
I didn't know that.
People about it. It looks, I'm embarrassed to say, I haven't been inside it either, but from the outside, all that glass.
It's gorgeous. It's absolutely gorgeous. And they do something that I love, which is, so they've created gallery space in the former residence, and it is on a hill, so it's very, very beautiful. And this is perfect for this show, too, which takes place on two different levels. So you go upstairs, you have what I call like the sorbet moment, where you can look out the windows, especially right now, you see these lush green trees, you can see the city off in the distance. So you free your eyes, you free your mind for a little bit. You can actually, I believe, you can still step outside onto their balcony and then come back in and see more art, but you just get to kind of cleanse your palate for a little bit before you continue on.
Yeah.
I could use the sorbet moment like right about now. So what are you doing? I actually always could, I guess. So what are you doing on that show of yours there, Jared Bowen?
Well, we'll take you all through Taking Shape, Abstraction from the Arab World, and then we're talking to two artists who are part of this group called 21 in Truro. This is a group of 21 women who have gathered the same week every single year and go down and paint in Truro, and they've been doing this for 23 years. There's now an exhibition at the Cape Cod Museum of Art of their work, them looking back at their own work. It's called Visions, Revisions, or Revisions.
Cannot wait.
Yeah, so it's really, really interesting.
Oh, what time of year? Do they always do it the same time of year?
They always do it in September, yes.
Wow, I never heard of that, and I've spent a lot of time in Truro. I cannot wait to hear.
They talk about erosion. They talk about erosion in their lives, how their lives have changed. Everything gets reflected in what they do on the canvas.
That sounds fabulous, actually.
All right.
Jared, good to see you.
Good to see you.
GBH Executive Arts Editor Jared Braun joins us regularly. He's the host of the TV series Open Studio. We just talked about that. You can catch the, what's it called?
The 21
and Truro. You can catch that this Friday night, 8:30 on GBH2. Jared, thank you so much. Coming up, we're asking you about UFOs. Is the government finally...
Don't, Marjorie, don't. Play this straight, can you please?
Is the government finally catching up with the rest of us, acknowledging if there are UFOs, or do you think this is just crazy? That's next on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Brody and Marjorie Egan. Can you behave professionally
during this
whole segment?
I will.
You promise?
I'll try.
Well, members of Congress can't agree on whether the 2020 election was stolen or if climate change is man-made. Could there at least be consensus on mysterious sightings in the sky? Finally, the U.S. government is acknowledging the existence of unidentified aerial phenomena, or as the rest of us call them, UFOs. After decades of public denial, this is amazing. The Pentagon is admitting there's something out there, and the U.S. Senate wants to know what it is. The Intelligence Committee has ordered the Director of National Intelligence and the Secretary of Defense, I think it is, to deliver a report to Congress by next month. We're taking your calls asking you about your UFO experiences. One, do you believe in them? And two, have you seen them? 877-301-8970. I didn't see the 60 Minutes thing I recorded. I haven't had a chance, but everybody is talking about it. These military, I think it's Navy people or
Navy
something.
Navy people, yeah. There's two people. This Lieutenant Graves guy who looks like a very serious guy. You know, this other person, a Lieutenant Commander, I guess, Dietrich, a woman there, talking about how, you know, they'd seen these things quite regularly. They just weren't by themselves either. They were with other pilots in the airplane looking at these things floating around, seeing they seem to have, like, no motor on them and hovering around. So, you know, this is the 60 Minutes reported that for some of these Navy pilots, seeing these UFOs were an ordinary event every day for the least a couple of years, is one of them.
Repeat that. Every day for a couple of years, they said,
yes,
right?
Yes. This is Ryan Graves, and he looks like a very normal guy. I mean, he was a lieutenant in the Navy. He's a Navy pilot, so you got to be pretty together to be a pilot, and that's what he thought. And they would see them together and talk about them. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's when you think about it, why should we presume that we're all by ourselves?
I agree completely.
I mean, the universe is a pretty big place, right?
Pretty big.
We're just in the solar system, which is a little tiny part of the Milky Way galaxy, and there are all these other galaxies floating around. So it seems presumptuous.
You ever seen anyone? You ever seen one?
I have not seen one, Jim. Have you?
Actually, I saw videos of the most recent QAnon convention, and yes, there were a lot of UFOs. No, I have not. I have not. Not ones where I came away saying that was UFO. I've seen weird stuff in the sky, but I've convinced myself, or others with me have convinced me, that it was a light reflection. You know, something that convinced me, rightly or wrongly, that it was just a natural phenomenon, or a plane or a helicopter, some such thing. But I have to say, we didn't pull together a poll for this, but every poll that I have seen, a huge percentage of people in this country say they have seen UFOs and believe in them.
Well, this another Navy pilot, this David Fravor guy, talked about in 2004 off Southern California. He and three other pilots spotted this unexplained large area of roiling white water surrounded by a calm sea. He described it as looking like this little white tic-tac just kind of moving among the white water area and not upsetting the sea around it. And this other tic-tac.
Well, let's talk. Speaking of him, let's get we have sound from him.
Oh, we do have sound from
this
him.
This is Naval aviator David Fravor. I don't know if you pronounce that way. He's with 60 Minutes host Bill Whitaker, who was hosting Jeopardy last week. I don't think it was great. Saying he believes the unidentified object he saw in 2004 was aware and mimicked consciously his movements in the air.
And just turns abruptly and starts mirroring me. So as I'm coming down, it starts coming up.
So it's mimicking your moves.
Yeah, it was aware we were there. You want to see how close I can get. So I go like this, and it's climbing still. And when it gets right in front of me, it just disappears.
Disappears?
Disappears. Like gone.
And you saw no visible propulsion, right. no wings or anything to make it fly in our atmosphere?
No, actually, when it turned and started coming up, it was kind of like, okay, because we have nothing that goes that fast and just starts climbing at will.
That's pretty chilling, is it not?
It's
really
great.
Is.
It's great. I mean, why not? Now, Jim, you've been making fun of me talking about getting beamed and probed. Mm-hmm. Liz just emailed. She said, living through the Trump presidency and then COVID, I feel like I have been beamed and probed. Doesn't everyone?
Yes, it's true. By the way, one last thing before we get to the calls. One of our coworkers, I think Mackenzie, pulled this together. Mm-hmm. There have actually, I wasn't aware of any serious UFO sightings in New England.
Oh, yes. Betty
87 in Newtown, Connecticut, which unfortunately became famous for another reason. Mm-hmm. Berkshire County in 69. Exeter, New Hampshire, 65. So not so much recently, I guess, but this is not just like a southwestern United States kind of phenomenon.
You left off Betty and Barney up in Lancaster, New
Hampshire. What was 61. Betty and Barney?
Betty and Barney, Benny Barney Hill, actually driving home from Niagara Falls mm-hmm. vacation. They saw a bright light moving erratically across the sky. They stopped their car. A disc-shaped UFO advanced wow. toward them. Both claim, Jim, guess mm-hmm. what?
No, don't say it. 877-301-8970. Andy and Milton, you're first on the UFO segment here on Boston Public Radio. Welcome.
Hello to you both.
Hi.
Hi. So I'm an Air Force vet. I had the pleasure of serving at Edwards Air Force Base out in California, which was the flight test center. So I got to see a lot of cool things out there. And aircraft that are, you know, it's the cutting edge technology that do things that you just blow your mind. But there's a great book that I read while I was stationed out there, Area 51. It's by Annie Jacobson, and it doesn't go into so much the alien stuff, but it talks about the development of the technology, everything from the U-2 spy plane through the SR-71 Blackbird. And she tells a couple stories that are great. There's one before jet propulsion was a thing. The military was developing this technology, and they would send the planes up, and it created contrails. And no one had ever seen those before because we didn't have any experience with it. So one of the pilots threw on a gorilla mask and flew up alongside just a civilian pilot.
Oh, no.
Basically, he thought he'd gone out of his mind. So I think when we're seeing this stuff, it's entirely possible that it is extraterrestrial, but I also think there's a strong possibility, and if not likelihood, that it's just technology that hasn't made it into the mainstream yet.
Before you go, Andy, you said you're an Air Force vet. Were you in the air as part of your job or no?
I was not, no.
Okay. Did you have colleagues, fellow members of the Air Force who had said they'd seen such things or no?
I knew a number of pilots, but no, none that had said that they'd seen anything.
Well, you're a more rational soul, apparently, than
well,
we are.
On,
but you also know more than we do.
Hold on one second, Andy. You know, lots of times, I mean, that's one of the things that they're talking about on 60 Minutes, that if you say these things, people do think you're a little bit out there. So maybe lots of people feel they best just keep it to themselves. You know what I mean?
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Andy, thanks. We appreciate
your
time. That's
why I haven't confessed my many sightings.
Yeah, okay. You know, Andy makes a really interesting point, though. I haven't heard of the woman, nor have I read that book, Area 51, or whatever he said.
Yep.
That's a pretty plausible explanation.
Very plausible.
That it's technology that's more advanced than that which we're used to. Mm-hmm. And as a result, you see it and you say, like this guy said, whatever his name is, naval aviator, David Fravor, I've never seen anything. What did he say? That turns like that and whatever else he said. So maybe Andy...
But to
has
me, like I'll repeat what I said before, to me it's just improbable that we are in this
totally
massive
agree.
Universe alone.
Totally, totally. And by the way, you know, we were talking to our chaplain about this a little while ago, mm-hmm. and he said something like, well, then why haven't we seen any of them? I assume you totally buy into what I mentioned to him, pod people. That who knows? Like, do I know that you're not a pod person? That you're not an... I'm serious. I don't know that you're not an alien, that you weren't
right.
deposited here from some far away kind of place. No, I'm serious. I mean, do you know or do you not know?
I don't know, Jim. I'm not really going with the pod people route yet.
Well, I am, actually. Joan in Providence, you're next on Boston Public Radio. We're talking about UFOs. Hello, Joan.
Hello.
Hello.
I've actually seen one.
Oh,
I believe that.
Good.
I'm not a crazy person. I'm
no,
not. I'm a regular, normal person like
you
everybody
sound very
else.
Regular to yeah. me, Joan.
Okay, so what'd you see?
It was in 1967 in the winter, in February, and I had just come home from my parents' home. I had just gotten married, so I had my own place. I had just come home.
Yeah.
And I was walking down the path to go to the back door. I have no reason why I was going the back door, but I don't know. There was a reason. And I heard this funny noise up in the sky. And I said, oh, a helicopter. I mean, in 67, helicopters didn't ride around at night. You know, mm-hmm. and I thought, that's kind of odd. And then I listened to it closer, and I said, it really doesn't sound like a helicopter. So I continued on my path across to the back door. And I looked up where I heard the sound, and it was this very black night. So you couldn't see the diameter of it. It just was something up there. The sound was like a whir, like a real low, like a whirring sound, not that whop, whop, whop that helicopters make. And I looked up, and there were lights around it, but, of course, I couldn't see the back, so I couldn't see how large it was. But I got such an eerie feeling, and I went immediately into the house. I got out of the back, and I called my father, and I said, Dad, come down and look at the house. And he said, why? I said, I don't know. I'm nervous. And I didn't want to tell him it was that because he never would have come. So I said, I think I see people looking in the windows, I think. There's someone looking in my windows. So he said, I'll be right down. He came down. He looked around. He said, there's nothing there. So he said, what's wrong? I said, well, I'm still nervous. Can you stay for a little while? And I told him, I think I saw a UFO in the
sky. What did he
say? And he just rolled his eyes. He said, do you have a little brandy in the house?
Wow.
He said, well, sit and have a little brandy before I go home. So I said, okay. Well, but then the next morning when I got up, I finally did go to sleep and rest. I did get in bed and think people were looking in. I got up. I went to work in the morning. I turned on the radio, and they said they were flooded with calls the night before of UFO sightings in Lincoln, Rhode Island.
Like that. Hey, Joan, that's a good one. Before you go away, do you know any people you think are pod people, even if you don't
don't.
You don't.
This is my. You want to know what my theory is?
What
why
is
they
it?
Don't come to bother us? Because they come and they look. And they see what they see, and they say, who the hell wants to go there?
Exactly. That is the best explanation I've heard yet. Joan from Providence, thank you for relating your UFO contact. We appreciate it.
Now, Paul said he and a bunch of friends were convinced that they had seen a UFO. They were all out looking at it at the same time, but tragically, it turned out to be the Goodyear blimp, Jim.
You've been on a blimp, by the way, which has
nothing. No, I haven't.
I'd really like
you?
To do that. No, I'd love to do that, though, by the way. Joan, thanks for the call. 877-301-8970. Prompted by this 60 Minutes thing the other night, where they were talking to, I think on the surface, credible people who, in the military in particular, said they've seen UFOs. Not to mention the fact, I didn't even know that there's an obligation, Secretary of Defense and the Director of National Intelligence, to present a report on this issue to Congress. This, I don't know if it's this month. It can't be, I guess. Well,
June,
it could be.
June.
What, June? Is that
I
what
think
it is?
So. Yeah.
That's pretty intense, is it not?
Very intense. Yeah, well, like I said, it's on 60 Minutes, Jim. 60 Minutes. Whitaker. What's his name? What's his first name?
Bill Whitaker. Whitaker.
Yeah. Bill Whitaker.
Did you see him hosting Jeopardy?
No, is he terrible?
Yeah, I like him on. I thought he was terrible. I like him a lot on 60 Minutes. I don't think he was there. Anderson Cooper was brilliant. He was the lowest rated host of all the hosts.
He was. Was Aaron? How about Aaron Rodgers?
He did pretty well too. But a lot of people think that's a phenomenon because a big football superstar was doing it. Let's go to Plymouth, where Rob is on the UFO Hour here on Boston Public Radio. Hi, Rob.
The legendary Jim Browdy.
That is correct.
He is a legend.
Wonderful, Marjorie.
Hey.
Marjorie.
Hey, Rob, how are you? What's coming?
I'm a long-time listener, but not a first-time
Good.
Caller.
Okay. Glad to have you back, Rob. What's
unfortunately
up?
Unfortunately for you.
That's all right. So have you been beamed and probed, Rob? Let's get down to brass tacks here. You've been beamed and probed or what?
No. Let's see what have you seen, Rob?
I've seen UFOs three times.
Really?
How?
One of them was when I was in the military in Georgia. This was probably late 80s. And we worked on classified aircraft, so we knew what was up there. You know, we had everything from nuclear bombers to stealth fighters on the base. So we knew what was up there. Me and five other guys, all of us worked on aircraft. We were out fishing in the middle of the big swamp between Savannah and Tybee Island.
Yeah.
So we're out in the middle fishing one night. We were camping out there, and we see this light flying over, coming from Savannah, just like kind of low, bright ball of light moving fast from Savannah. And we watch it, and it gets like where it would be like out over the ocean or out over Tybee Island. And we see another light come in from the north, and another one come in from the south.
Whoa.
And then do you remember, and they all kind of met up in the middle, and do you remember the old movie Tron? Did you ever see Tron?
I think I did, but I'm not sure.
They do like 90 degree turns.
I don't remember.
These things started for like maybe 5-10 seconds. Started doing right angle turns around each other in the sky. Ooh. Nothing can do that.
Rob, were you and the other four guys under the influence at that time or no? I'm serious. Was that one of those things or no?
We were in the Army. We might have had a few beers or something. You know, we were out on boats, so we were coherent enough to drive the boats around.
So what did the five of you conclude you'd seen?
Well, we all thought we saw UFOs.
Wow.
And we went back and told, but they all grouped up in the middle and then took off just out and poof, they were going up in the sky. We told our sergeants. And I was short at the time. I was going to be getting out in like a month.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, if you say anything about this, you guys are going to go to Leavenworth, Worth, or a psych ward. Don't ever talk about it again.
Well, if I were you under those circumstances, I wouldn't. And I think you're safe now. Rob, thanks for calling yet again. We appreciate it. 877-301-897. That sounds incredible to me.
Absolutely. Remember Richard Dreyfuss in Close Encounters of the Third Kind?
Was that the best picture of an extraterrestrial vehicle?
He lost his marbles. He's building all these mountains all the time in his basement, and his wife is going bananas. His kids are going bananas. And he takes off and with a bunch of other people that are building mountains all the time in the middle of their house, mm-hmm. You know, like 8 feet long mountains made out of dirt. Yeah. You know, turn us all
You know on. That was a movie, right? You do know it was a movie.
I know it was a movie. And we know what happened to Richard Dreyfuss, right?
We do.
He got in the spaceship.
And what was he exactly?
Being probed.
So let me tell you, for those who haven't seen that, was that the best special effects of an extraterrestrial vehicle you've ever seen in your whole life in the movies?
It was great. I loved it.
It's unbelievable.
It was a really
Roger
good movie.
In Gloucester, we only have a minute and it's yours. Hi, Roger.
Well, hello.
Hi.
Hello to you.
Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Great. Thank you.
And, you know, I think it's great that you're ending your show on a topic that is either the most important thing that we've talked about in the months or is, you know, just a good laugh to end the show with.
Mm.
But I have a theory as to why we have not had visitors.
Why?
30 seconds. What is it?
Okay. You know the Big Bang Theory?
Yeah.
Everything started 13 billion years ago, whatever. And if you say that, you know, stars all take roughly the same time to evolve and galaxies take the same time to evolve and life takes the same time to evolve and civilization, then each of those possible life forms, civilizations out there, have taken, you know, about the same time, about 13 billion years to get to the point where they could travel in space. And therefore, if they are, you know...
Roger, we're like about out of time, so get to the point, because we're almost out of time.
Here's the point, that if those civilizations are hundreds of light years away or millions of light years away, we wouldn't hear about them for hundreds or millions of years.
Excellent point. Roger, we got to go. Make your second call soon, we hope. Thank you very much for the call. I'm convinced.
Oh, absolutely. They're out there, Jim. They are out there. Thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tomorrow, Governor Charlie Baker is going to be with us. We'll ask him about UFOs.
Yeah, why don't you do it? I think that'd be good.
Okay.
I think that'd be good.
Andrew Cabral will join us for Law and Order, and Corby Kummer, our food man. We want to thank our crew, Chelsea Murs, Zoe Matthews, Hannah Ubeley, Aiden Conley, Mackenzie Farkas. Our engineer is John the Claw Parker. Our offsite engineers are Miles Smith and Dave Goldstein. You going to do UFOs tonight in TV, Jim?
No, sadly I'm not. But Jill Shaw was with us yesterday, runs the Shaw Family Foundation, is going to be joined tonight by the city manager of Chelsea, Tom Ambrosino. Together, they are leading the largest guaranteed income project in the United States of America. They think it's a big success, they're going to tell us. Why Congressman Jim McGovern from Worcester, chair of the House Rules Committee, went nuts yesterday in the best sense of the word after Kevin McCarthy did a 180 on this bipartisan commission to look into January 6th. He'll join me. And Adam Riley's got a really interesting package about how while Charlie Baker is wildly popular again amongst the general public, not so much within his own party. And if he runs for re-election, it may be a hurdle. He's going to talk about that. It's all tonight, Greater Boston, at 7 o'clock.
It's a beautiful day out today. I guess you can go home, and when the stars come out tonight, check it out. You never know what you'll see.
Never know.
I'm Marjorie Egan.
I'm Pod Person Jim Browdy. See you tomorrow.
Bye.
Bye.